Last time we talked quite a bit about the basis for the EEG signal. We talked about alpha and where it comes from, and we talked quite a bit about how to acquire the signals in a digital form and look at the frequency characteristics of them. And today's focus will mostly be on applications of frequency domain EEG after we take a few questions from last time in the form of 3x5 cards and then show some demonstrations in terms of how we go through processing these signals. A couple of announcements, the first one of which you might be a little tired of hearing by now. A couple of you have already sent me your topics. One of you approved, one of you mostly approved. The rest of you just get them to me by email before the start of class next week. Okay? And I'll try to give you some useful feedback and tell you that you're ready to go. And on to the 3x5. So we were talking last time about this idea of alpha blocking. Remember, alpha is present when the cortex underneath seems not to be actively processing information. And one of the early examples of that is that if people close their eyes, you'll see alpha predominate over the occipital cortex. And when they open their eyes, you'll see it blocked. And so a question came up, if I present stimuli only to the left visual field of a participant, can I expect that I'll see alpha waves on electrodes over the right hemisphere? First of all, I think a correction. So if we present it to the left visual field, it will go to the right hemisphere, so we'd expect to see alpha blocking over the right hemisphere. So let me just change the question, like a politician would, to say, would I see only alpha waves over the left hemisphere, right? The hemisphere that's not actively processing the information in a split field paradigm. It's a great experiment idea. I didn't see that it's been done. I'm assuming it's been done, but I found something else that I think is pretty interesting and closely related to that. So this comes from a Journal of Neuroscience 2000 paper, and this was an attention cueing paradigm. So subjects get a cue very briefly at the center of fixation to tell them they'll be attending either to the right or to the left. There's then a delay, during which time they have to prepare for a target or non-target to come up on either side, and it can come up, you know, opposite the cued direction or the same as the cued direction, depending on which trial it is. So this isn't actually split field just in terms of presentation, but also in terms of where attention is allocated. So looking at these results, it's a fairly complicated figure. Let's ignore the ERP for now, since we're going to cover ERPs in a couple of weeks. They had oodles of electrodes, and they're just taking a couple of sample electrodes from the posterior occipital region here. They're not right along the midline because the occipital cortex is organized such that, you know, foveal is going to be here, and as you move from the fovea, it'll go out laterally. This is alpha TSE, and TSE just stands for temporal spectral evolution. It's a fairly simple way of calculating alpha power in a moving window over time. So what they do is they simply filter the signal in the alpha frequency band, and then they do a full wave rectification. So you look at alpha, and then if it's a negative, you flip it to a positive, just like we did with EMG, and this gives you an idea of alpha power over time. So what you see is when the stimulus actually comes up, there's alpha blocking no matter what the condition. But then there's this divergence of alpha power late in the epoch, depending on the direction of the cue, and it reverses for each side of the electrode. So if we look over here, this is a left hemisphere electrode, and if they're cued to the right, we would expect this cortex might be more active in processing the anticipated stimulus. Right. So, cued to the right, we see there's less alpha than when it's cued to the left. If it's cued to the left, then this cortex is going to need to be more active. So, this one isn't as active there. And the pattern reverses there. So there does seem to be some hemispheric specificity for visual processing. And this doesn't answer the question directly in terms of what if we just present it split field, but it goes one step further and looks at cued attention and its effects on visual cortex. Okay. Another question. There were a series of frequently asked questions having to do with aliasing and the Nyquist frequency, so various forms of them. One of them was, what if a wave of 50 hertz was sampled at, a wave of 50 hertz were sampled at 100 hertz in the following way, and the person characterize a diagram that looks something like this. So if this is our 50 hertz waveform, and we'll talk about this as a cosine wave, so one cycle goes from here to here, there are two samples per cycle, two samples per cycle, two samples per cycle. So technically this is at the Nyquist frequency, but you can see if that were your digital representation, it looks like you have no signal at all. Okay, so how does that capture any frequency info? Well, if you really are getting a signal that's at the Nyquist, you're living dangerously. You're not going to capture the full morphology of that waveform. Your ability to resolve its amplitude is going to be compromised. You'd be seriously unlucky if this happened. Okay, it would be just exactly time-locked the whole time. Okay, so you're probably not going to be that unlucky, but you wouldn't really want to plan to sample only twice as high as your highest frequency of interest. Right? So you need, a lot of times the amplifiers that are controlled by a computer don't even let you sample only twice the highest frequency present. They'll force you to sample four or sometimes six times as high as the highest frequency present. So you'll certainly avoid that problem. Okay. Now related to that, I'm still confused about the Nyquist frequency and its exact definition. I understand the aliasing and the folding back, but the quote sample rate twice as fast as the highest signal still confuses me somewhat. So let's go back to our friend Harry Nyquist and his principle here. So remember, to represent your signal, you have to sample fast enough. And his theorem is that you have to sample twice as fast as the highest signal frequency. Okay, at least that fast, as we just saw. Okay, so the highest frequency that you can accurately represent, and maybe accurately isn't quite right here, that you can represent at all without it being aliased, is one half of that sampling rate. And that's what's known as the Nyquist frequency. It is just one half the sampling rate. So you can look up your sampling rate, and you better know that there's no frequencies higher than one half of that present in your signal, or you're going to have trouble with aliasing. Now, although this first person got folding back, the second person doesn't quite get folding back. So let me try this one more time with the help of a Java animation that I found for this. Okay. So I think these people aren't dealing with EEG, but probably with acoustic stimuli, because they have a sampling rate of 8,000 hertz. Okay, that's pretty high. And so the Nyquist, of course, would be
16,000?
No, 4,000. 4,000, right. So let's go ahead and put in a 4,000 hertz signal. We'll plot it. There it is. And we'll plot the sample points. And they look just like that diagram that somebody put on that 3x5 card. We're getting two per cycle, but this thing has forced it to be right in the midpoint of the cycle, so it's useless. Okay,
2,000.
Okay, so 2,000 should be just fine, right?
Yeah.
You get the peak and the valley. And I'm plotting the sample points on there so that you can see it. Okay. Now, let's go here to, let's go beyond the Nyquist. Our Nyquist is 4,000. Let's go to 5,000. And now those sample points, if you look at them, it may or may not pop out at you, but you can also, with this little demonstration, plot the alias frequency. So you can see it there. And you can see that the blue peaks in this interpolated signal come less often, or a greater distance between them, than the yellow peaks. So even though this signal, 5,000 hertz, is faster than the input signal, it's appearing as slower than the input signal. Okay. Now, the folding back part was that it's pretty easy to understand this, that when your x hertz over the Nyquist, you'll look like your x hertz under the Nyquist. Okay. So here we're 1,000 over the Nyquist, and we look like we're 1,000 under the Nyquist. Well, that works really well until you're double the Nyquist, right? So if we go out to double the Nyquist, which is our sampling rate, because right? If the Nyquist frequency is half the sampling rate, then double the Nyquist is the sampling rate, and we'll plot that, and now we see that we get, again, it puts it right in the center, just to make the point really clear, and if you treat this as a sine wave, so this is one cycle here, we're getting right at the beginning of each cycle. So now 4,000 hertz plus 4,000 is the same as 4,000 minus 4,000, so it looks like 0 hertz. Okay. Well, you can't now keep going, right, we'd start having negative frequencies, which aren't defined. Right? So it now begins to march back up. So if we would go to 9,000, you can see it again looks like 1,000 hertz. It's no different than 1,000 hertz. Okay, so if I go to 1,000 here, there's 1,000, and I'll just plot those, and then if I go to 9,000, it's the same, right? So it just marches back up until now it gets to a multiple of the Nyquist again. So we went to 4,000 to 8,000, now we go up to 12,000, and at 12,000, there we're right back to the same old problem that we had initially. So it just goes up and down in an accordion-like fashion. Okay? So that's the folding back. So maybe make the point one more time. With two different signals that are aliased, we can think of 5,000 hertz and 13,000 hertz. Okay? 5,000 hertz is 1,000 hertz over this Nyquist frequency. 13,000 hertz is 1,000 over three times the Nyquist frequency. They will look exactly the same. So if we plot 5,000 here, that's what our sampled signal looks like. Okay, I'll show you, there's the input signal just to show you we're not pulling any fast ones. And if I put on 13,000 here and I plot it, it doesn't change. Even though that input signal looks very different. So if I take away the alias plotting line and I plot 13,000 versus 5,000, you'll see the actual signal that we have going in looks very different. But given our sampling rate, we can't resolve any difference between them. Aliasing is one of these problems that, you know, it's lethal. If you collect all your hard-earned dissertation data and you've got aliasing, there's just not going to be much that you can do. So you really want to make these sample rate decisions and filter decisions very carefully at the outset. Let me just pause and see if you want to try anything else on the applet to clarify things. Okay, there we go. Can you say a bit more about what power is? What does the y-axis mean? How much of the signal is it? How much of the signal is at that frequency? And the person provided a diagram on the card that looks something like this, but didn't label the y-axis, and so I labeled it to tell you that power is microvolts squared. And it is indeed how much of the signal is at that frequency, but it's not how much in a relative sense, like the proportion of the signal. It's how much in some absolute sense. Okay. So you see in this signal, there's a nice strong alpha peak. In fact, that's the highest power of any single frequency is right there in the alpha spectrum. There's also a low frequency delta peak, and this signal has obviously been filtered because there's nothing right here, so it probably has maybe a 1 hertz high pass filter on it. So power is microvolts squared because the way the FFT works, that's a power spectrum. Sometimes people will use an amplitude spectrum, and an amplitude spectrum is simply taking the square root at each of these points in time. So there's point space at intervals here that are equal to 1 over the length of the epoch that you fed into the FFT. So here's 25, so that would actually be 5 in an amplitude spectrum. And it really pulls it down and sometimes has better psychometric properties to it because the data won't be quite so skewed. Okay. A simple question, does the conductive paste, I assume for EEG, have the same chemical makeup as gels used for EDA recording? No. That's not really an adequate answer. So, no. EDA paste would work. It would be fine. But it's not going to be as conductive as these hypertonic solutions. So the EEG gels that we use tend to have greater saline concentration than natural saline. And by doing so, they'll be more conductive. That would be a real problem if we were doing skin conductance, but because we're just trying to conduct signals that are already inside the body, we want to pick them up as well as possible. We want to use the best conductive gel that we can. There are a variety of different gels, and the thing that I used for the demo was actually a gel and a kind of a sticky paste that would allow us to have the electrode stick as well. Okay. Some of the newer gels also have chemicals in them that start to break down skin oils and kind of even in some of the nastier cases work away at some of the dead skin cells so that you can reduce impedance as well. Some of them will use potassium chloride, for example. Too much of that, though, and subjects tend to have an adverse reaction, and they can start itching or stinging or burning. So in our lab, we have one of these newer gels, which has some of the potassium chloride in it, but for any subject who has a reaction on the first or second electrode, we'll switch over to an older gel, which is just a hypertonic sodium chloride gel. Okay. You know what? There was one other thing I worked very hard to get, and it's not showing up here, so I'll come back to that in a second. I asked you last time what you thought of the demos, and people thought that the demos were a really good idea. So that was pretty much ubiquitous among anybody who expressed an opinion, so I appreciate that. I don't have any more demos now because from here on out we're talking about how we process data, but I'll be doing demos instead of with a person here, I'll be doing demos with data that we have. Okay. And now today's opinion poll is, what do you think of taking time for the 3x5 queries? Sometimes these take a bit of time away from other things that I could do in class and in preparing, so if you like them, just let me know. So I had this real problem with these 3x5 cards. They came up like they always do on my computer, and I came here and they just came up as one big mess. And I'm not sure what to attribute that to other than gremlins. But the question that we had was something like, I don't understand how the Tamming taper solves the problem of a periodic signal. Remember, we talked about this problem where if a signal doesn't end at an exact multiple of its frequency, you'll have some discontinuities in the FFT and you'll get all kinds of extra frequencies. And the question was, well, how does the Hamming take care of that? And to address this, I've created a little bit of simulation data that we'll take a look at in MATLAB. Now, you'll see MATLAB a couple of additional times this semester in lecture and potentially in lab. So I'm just logging onto a computer that has MATLAB. MATLAB is a programming environment, and we have a campus site license for this program. The nice thing about it is you can find scripts to do all kinds of things, and so I found a script and modified it here for these purposes to show us what a Hamming window does and what its impact is on the FFT. Okay? So this is MATLAB programming language. And you can just define variables as you like, and then there are a bunch of built-in functions. And anything with a percent in front of it is simply a comment. So I'm just, you know, commenting that this is where the code came from. We're going to start with an epoch length of 256, which is conveniently a power of 2, because remember that the FFT likes a power of 2. And we're actually going to have our signal only be part of that length. So there'll be a built-in discontinuity to this signal. So the signal is about half that length of 128. We're going to create a Hamming window H, and Hamming is just a function built into a signal processing toolbox in MATLAB. And what I'll do to start is I can run any portion of this. I'm just going to evaluate this selection, and at the end of this I'm going to open up a figure and plot that Hamming window for you. And so what I've done so far is I've created a couple of variables. Oops, we'll get to that later. I've created a variable H, which is the Hamming window. And I've created a variable m, which is a single integer, and a variable n, which is a single integer. And the Hamming window is a series of weights that look like this. The point in the middle of the epoch is weighted very heavily, and the points out towards the end are weighted close to zero. So they get very little weight. Now, that then causes any signal that may have a value that's not close to zero at the end to have a value that's close to zero at the end. So then if we were to imagine appending signals one to the next to the next to the next, any discontinuity would be very, very small. Okay? It won't be gone, but it'll be very small, and it will result in a less problematic effect on the FFT. So then if we go back to the code here, we're going to create a couple of vectors that are just a bunch of zeros. We're going to have a raw signal, and we'll have a Hamming weighted signal. But to start with, we're going to make them both be a bunch of zeros. So I'm just going to create that. And zeros is a function in MATLAB that just puts zeros in there for you. And if you don't believe me, we can actually plot that function, which should be nothing but zeros. So we'll plot the raw signal, SR, and let's see, there it is, it's zeros, okay? Nothing fancy there, but we're going to then put a signal into about half of it here in the next step. We're going to define an arbitrary frequency of pi, and then we're going to create the signal that's the length of the signal using a sine wave function right here. And then I'm going to plot that, and it's going to overwrite the zeros in the first half, and then we'll plot the waveform. So evaluate that. And now you see we have a nice sine wave going here, and then it just stops. Okay, so clearly this is not a particularly periodic signal. Now we're going to do the same thing, but apply the Hamming window to it as well, and then I'm going to plot the Hamming windowed signal on top of this signal in red. Okay. So what I do here is I multiply each Hamming window point times the sine wave point, and that applies the weight to it, and then by holding the plot I can plot on top of it, and by plotting with the parameter R I can plot it in red. So we'll just do that, and there we see now towards the end, you know, there's not much of a discontinuity, it kind of tapers towards zero at the end. So this is what it would, the Hamming window signal would look like in the red. If you can't see that quite so clearly, let me just run back and plot it alone. So signal Hamming. Let's just delete that plot. Well, sometimes it continues to write over things. So there it is. That's the Hamming windowed signal. You can see it's been applied to that. So now, I guess the question is, how much does that help us in terms of getting rid of spurious frequencies in the FFT? So these next two lines just conduct the FFT on the raw signal and on the Hamming signal. So we have the FFT on the raw and the FFT on the Hamming. And we'll do that. Nothing, you won't see anything really happen except you get a couple of new variables. And I'm finally going to create a plot with four subplots in it so we can see the results of everything. And what we have here is the raw signal that clearly isn't periodic. And here's the FFT we get. And we get a big spike at the dominant frequency, but we have a bunch of other kind of crud trailing out on either side that we wouldn't really like to be there. When we apply the Hamming window and then do the FFT, you can see there's really not much crud on either side. There is a little bit of spread here. Really, there should just be a single point. There's still a little bit of spread, but it clearly reduces the amount of spread of those spurious frequencies by implementing the Hamming window. If we had a perfectly periodic signal, then you could probably get that to be just a spike. But you'd have to sample it. You'd have to get exactly, you know, an integer number of periods of the signal. Now, there are a variety of windows. They all look kind of like bells. One's called a cosine bell. There's the Hamming. There's the Hanning, H-A-N-N, instead of H-A-M-M, Hanning and Hamming. And all they differ by is kind of how flat and how peaked they are, how much the, you know, when the roll-off occurs. So they're slightly different in terms of how they start tapering and how sharp that taper is towards the end. Hamming is fairly standard. Hanning is fairly standard as well. Okay. So any questions on Hamming windows? Okay. If you're interested, next Monday and Tuesday, the university is giving some free courses on MATLAB, and there's a Fundamentals of MATLAB basic one, both Monday and Tuesday. If you're interested, email me and I'll get you the web link to it, and any university staff, student, or faculty member can attend. It's nice if you ever want to do any simulation work. And it's not just for signals. You can do pretty much anything. You can run your own ANOVA in this if you want to build it from scratch. Okay. All right. So we'll come back to that in a minute. All right. Any other questions before we continue with new material? That's almost new material, because what we left off with last time was I'd covered a lot of material and I was going to apply it to some actual data. So we're going to take a look at taking EEG data and turning it into frequency domain representations. So that's what we'll do next. And for this, I'm going to go back to this terminal server. And what I have open here is just a series of EEG data, but I've made it purposely kind of short so we don't have to wait around for it to process all the data. You can get the main point by just looking at a short segment of data. As we look at the data here, we have an annoying little window that NeuroScan always puts up, and we have 64 channels of data. At the bottom, we have an EKG signal that we're really not going to be interested in for today's purpose. We have a couple of leads here, vertical and horizontal EOG, that are monitoring eye movements, and all of the other sites are scalp sites, and they're referenced online to a reference that's just posterior to CZ. Okay, so that's the online reference for these data. Because of that, you can see that CZ, which is just adjacent to the reference, shows very small fluctuations relative to the other channels. But it does show some fluctuations if you, you know, move it, and you can blow it up a little bit. One of the features that you notice quite clearly is this blip here that's fairly slow. That's an eye blink, and you could tell that because you can also see it perhaps here in the eye blink channel, the vertical EOG. That might be more visible. There's a feature again right up there. And here we can see the eye blink channel a little more clearly. What I've done on these two, I've taken the first 32 and the second 32 channels and assigned them to a view so that when I go through these pages, you don't have to see all 64. Sometimes it's kind of hard unless you have a really killer monitor. Before we actually go ahead and do an FFT on some of the data, let's look at a couple of the other features of the data. One thing that we notice, I pointed out the eye blink there, and you notice that it's primarily restricted to those frontal sites. Okay? You don't see it much as you move towards the back of the head. So generally speaking, we're going from front to central to parietal to occipital as we're moving this way. Okay. The color codes we put on there for left frontal, right frontal, left parietal, right parietal. So you can kind of, you know, visualize them by color. Another feature you might notice is that some of these leads appear to have some higher frequency activity, like this one, T8, which is going to be right over here. Here we have TP8 just behind it, even M2, which is a mastoid here. So there are muscles there, and that higher frequency activity is probably muscle activity. It's pretty static, so the person might just have a little bit of muscle tension as they're sitting there. Now, these amplifiers are recording in what's called DC mode, so it allows the signals to drift, having huge differences in baselines, which isn't anything of interest. In fact, it's kind of a nuisance for what we're doing here. So I'm just going to get rid of baseline differences, but you can see this one's oscillating around minus 18,000 units, and this is oscillating around 7,900 units. It's obviously huge differences between them that would be kind of a problem for trying to visualize them and what I'm going to do next. So I'm going to add a display filter in this program. This program just lets us filter the data that we see without actually changing the real data. The real data are still safely tucked away on the hard drive. And I'm going to issue a high-pass filter at 1 hertz. So signals of 1 hertz will be cut to half their amplitude. Things below that will be cut even more, and things above that will pass. And I'm going to apply it to all channels, and I'm going to say OK. And the first thing, it looks like it ruined the data. But this is just because the filter didn't know what to do at the beginning. If you kind of comb through a few pages, it applies filter to every page as we go. Now things actually look a little bit more reasonable. OK. So here we have that blink. It's changed its form a little bit because of the filter. And that's natural what happens with these filters. You get kind of a biphasic effect with that. But what I'd like to show you is another way of looking at the data that we'll talk about in more detail in the advanced topics, and that's looking at how the frequency characteristics on any given channel change as a function of time. And so what I'm doing is I'm putting on what's called a continuous wavelet. We'll talk about wavelets in a little bit more detail in a few weeks. But for right now, what you're seeing is frequencies. So this is 8 hertz, 16 hertz, 32, 63, 125, and 250 hertz. And that's just constrained by the sample rate of the data. Time here corresponds to time here, and the colors correspond to the power that you have in a various frequency band. So looking at this channel, which is currently highlighted, which is FP1, what we see is the dominant feature here is some kind of low frequency activity. It looks like it's below 8 hertz. and it's quite intense. And that
this blink, it's a very low power but high amplitude feature.
Now we could contrast that to, say, another site. Let's see if it's, which one of these has some EMG, maybe T8. Okay, T8 looks quite different. Every channel, unfortunately, gets scaled to the minimum and maximum values within that channel, so you can't really compare across channels. We can see there is some kind of slow frequency activity, but look at this activity all across this broad spectrum from about 30 hertz on up. Now, if you read today's lecture, you might be all excited. This is 40 hertz or gamma band or the readings for today, you might think it's gamma band activity. You know, we're looking at neural binding, but this is probably just EMG given the location of this electrode over on the side of the head. And every time there's an EMG burst, you see this kind of broad spectrum of activity. And remember, EMG has a broad spectrum of activity. We talked about a few lectures ago. Let me turn it off for a minute because Neuroscan sometimes crashes if you move ahead with this thing on. Right here, this awful looking feature that says SS is a start-stop. We actually paused the recording and then we started it again. So it's a discontinuity that's built in to the signal. And what you'll see when you apply the continuous wavelet transform on something like this is that this thing creates a huge artifact. Look at it here for FP1, for example, that has a broad spectrum of activity. So you wouldn't want to include that in your data. That's a problem that no amount of windowing is going to take out. You've got a clearly non-periodic signal, and it's just going to create havoc for the FFT. Later on in this file, now we have an eyes closed segment, and you can see very clear examples of alpha waves going here. And so if we look at that in the continuous wavelet transform and we choose one of these more posterior sites, like, is that a P8 looks pretty good. You can see right here, this is 8 to 16, so this appears to be in the 8 to 12 hertz bandwidth. There's a lot of alpha activity. It dominates that channel. And you can see it itself comes at somewhat periodic intervals. So it's a periodic signal that itself is coming at periodic intervals. And so we'll talk about that process later in advanced topics as well. Now, so that's a posterior site, but contrast that, for example, again with one of these temporal sites, which seems to have some kind of EMG spiking going on. Yeah, it's still got its alpha going. Maybe I chose the wrong one. Well, alpha seems to dominate a lot of this. That's nice to know. Okay. And by the way, the EKG, if you do this to that, what you'll see, you can very clearly see the regular appearance of the EKG waveform, which has a broad set of frequencies, and it's not particularly periodic, so it also has some, you know, spurious frequencies showing up. If there's anything else to show you before we then actually... this will be good. So now we have alpha, and then all of a sudden an EMG burst that comes across a large number of channels. So right now we're still on the EKG channel, but let's start by looking at... looks like F7 got hit pretty hard. There. So you can see here the EMG activity that's present for the duration of this burst and cuts across a wide range of frequencies, including those higher frequencies like gamma that we'll talk about later today. But you can see that if we go to one of these more posterior sites, here is some really clear alpha scalloping, and look, that's the dominant feature for that epoch. Okay. So that's one way of looking at the data, but what we're going to do is go back to the FFT. So what I'm going to do is take this file and chop it up into a series of say, 2-second epochs, and actually be a little more than 2 seconds because I want the number of points to be a power of 2 because we're going to be using an FFT, and FFT requires a power of 2. In this program, that's pretty easy to do. You can do this by point and click or by some scripting language that I'll show you at the end. So you can epoch the file. And we already have some little codes put in here every 500 milliseconds, so it makes it easy just to epoch it. And I'll start right at the appearance of every code, and I'll go for a little over a second. That way I'll get a little more data. So I have 1,024 points, which is a good power of 2. If I've marked any of these things bad, I won't include it. I wouldn't want to include those. Although, you know what? I think I will include them because then we can find out how bad they look in terms of the FFT. And then I have to save it as some kind of file. And I think I created a folder on the desktop called Demo, and we'll call it Epict. And we say go, and it just chops up the file, and then excuse me, it'll open up this new file, and now we see a different view of this. What we see here is all the sites on the head, and we see about a little over 1 second of data here for that particular epic. Let me make that a little bigger for you. And then as you move ahead, there's the next epic and the next and the next and the next. So that's just, you know, views of the data as you go marching along. Now as you look at this, it looks like we have killed the subject because there's no activity at a whole bunch of these sites. The reason for that is those large DC offsets. Some of these things are oscillating around 16,000 or minus 9,000, and you won't see them. So the next step I'll do, just so you can see this, is to issue a baseline correction. And I will center everything on the average of all the points in the epoch. So I'll take the average of every point and subtract it from each point. So I'll take the entire sweep. I'll do that for every channel. And we'll call this epoch and based. Okay. I'll make everything into a verb. Okay. So epoch and based, or adjective, I guess. All right, and here we go, and it's a very quick process as well. And now we see the subject has returned. And we have lots of sites. Let me maximize this to the extent that I can and get this crappy window out of the way. Now, as you
know, what did you just study?
So compared to the previous one right here, epic.
I mean, I heard you, but I just got
okay.
Washed over me.
It's okay. So for every site, I took the average of every sample and subtracted it from each sample. So I'm just now looking at oscillations around a zero baseline instead of oscillations around this arbitrary drift that might be happening in the signal. Okay. And so it looks like this. So everything's oscillating around zero now. And as you just look at that, you may notice it looks like there's kind of a dead spot in the middle of the head compared to around the side, and that's because the reference is right here. And with things closer to the reference, there can't be much difference between that reference lead and those leads. We'll re-reference things later. We'll be talking about that a bit more later as well. And if you were to look at, let's say, T8, that was one of those with a lot of EMG, you can see how spiky that one is as you go through. Now, eyes are closed. Look at all that alpha all of a sudden. Okay. And the reason I know eyes are closed, other than a good guess, is we have codes. Odd numbers are eyes open and even numbers are eyes closed. And this little box is just telling me that this is one of the eyes closed. It's a trial 4. Whereas if I go back a couple, now it's a type 3. It's an eyes open. Mm-hmm.
One good question. Why is the reference in that area again?
That's where the cap put it.
Okay.
it's central. You know, it's not likely to fall off. Mastoids can fall off. It's not lateralized in case there's anything unusual there. If you're interested in asymmetry, you have a midline reference. So it's a reasonable place to put it. Okay. Okay. So now we have all these epochs. What I'd like to do is transform each epoch into its frequency domain representation, and then we can look at the two side by side. So to do that, there's something called a forward FFT. Of course, NeuroScan doesn't have a backward FFT, it just has a forward FFT. And what this is going to do is create a new file, and so we'll call this epoch-based FFT'd. Okay. All right. And it's just doing it, and I don't think it actually does much in the way of windowing, so we'll get a few spurious frequencies, but they won't be terrible. It might apply a Hamming. So you get this other thing, it doesn't look too interpretable. I'm going to make a change to make it look much more attractive here. And I'm going to make it be colored histograms. So now I get these histograms, and if I look at, like, let's take a look at an occipital site here, like OZ. Now, and it's even color-coded things, so delta is in blue, theta is in green,
alpha's in red, beta up to 30 hertz is in yellow, everything else is in white except for 50 and 60 hertz, which are the line frequencies of, you know, most of the world and the North American countries. You can see there's some 60 cycle noise, even though we have a subject grounded and even though we have pretty good amplifiers, there's some 60 cycle noise leaking through here. In the back of the head, alpha is pretty prominent. There's also some very slow frequency activity as well. But if we compare that to a frontal site at the same point in time, we should see there being less alpha. Maybe a little less alpha on that one. Maybe it would be more pronounced if we go to an eyes closed epoch. So let's open O2 over here, and we'll try to get these things lined up. So if I move ahead, oh, there we go. These are only a couple. We'll go to the second eyes closed epoch there. So there's the first and the second. Okay. So we'll get O2 here. It doesn't look like I'd expect. There's a bunch of extra noise that I don't expect to see there. Let's see. It's maybe because this doesn't do a very good job of windowing the thing. Let's see. Let's see if maybe. There's clearly alpha predominating here, but there is some noise on top of it. It could be we're getting some noise from the reference lead. So if we again look at OZ here, and just need to figure out if it's the same epoch. So it was the second eyes closed epoch. Looks like we're picking up a lot of 60 cycle noise, which is what you see riding on here. Go ahead a little further in here and see if we can get something a little bit cleaner. So that would be epoch 25. Nope. Just doesn't look particularly attractive. I was hoping this would be more dramatic than it is. One thing you can see, however, is you notice all of the high frequency activity. This is well over 40 hertz, well over 60 hertz, out here on these leads that are along the sides. That's the muscle activity that you see as you get out where the EMG from the temporal leads is. Okay. Now this isn't the way we'd usually analyze the data because this is resting data, the person's sitting there, and we don't want to know right now, we don't have anything to lock this to, we don't know what the person's doing at this time, so we want to see what is the frequency characteristic over the entire interval. And to do that, we could average the frequency domain representations. And so there's an average function, and it lets us average in the frequency domain. We'll choose a power spectrum because that's what's usually used. We'll choose a Hamming window, which you now know what that is. And let's look just at eyes closed, which is type 4 in this data set. And we'll send it to an output file, which is eyes closed. And now I have just one single epoch, one single power spectrum instead of one for each epoch. Again, it doesn't look as attractive as if I change it to the histogram feature. Okay. Now this one with the window cleans things up quite a bit. Now you can see that the alpha really does predominate in O2. So I think actually some of what we were seeing with that forward FFT was the lack of windowing that NeuroScan wasn't doing any windowing. But when I apply the Hamming window, you can really see, there we go. So alpha is clearly the predominant feature in the eyes closed in the occipital lead, but if we look at, say, FP2, that dominant feature is in fact delta activity. Does anybody have an idea why you'd see delta activity up there? You think their frontal lobes are sleeping? Or do you think it might be something else? Hint, hint. It is something else. Their eyes are rolling. Okay. When eyes close, the EOG, they'll roll, and they'll roll at about 1 hertz or less. And so you see In fact, right here, this is about 0.5 hertz, and there's 1 hertz.
So they're just very slow rolling eye movements while the subject has his or her eyes closed. Okay. So you see that up front. If we go over here and look at one of these temporal leads, there's some alpha. There's a little EMG there. Still at darn 60 cycle miles. I don't think this subject was grounded quite as well as we might have liked. Now the EKG, again, remember, is not a periodic signal, and you see all kinds of frequencies represented in the EKG. Okay. So let's imagine that you were doing this to a file and you were kind of happy with your data processing stream. This program, NeuroScan, which those of you in the lab will be using for the first lab, allows you to look at the history of the command. So every time I pointed and I clicked, it generated some code that NeuroScan understands. It's different language than the MATLAB code that we were working with just a moment ago. But for example, we opened up a continuous file, and we epicked that file, we opened that file, we did baseline correction, we opened that file, we did the forward FFT, we closed some things, we opened up the file again that had the baseline corrected, and we did the average on only the eyes closed, and then we opened up that file as well. Each of these is something you can look up in a manual, and those of you in the lab will show you where that is, but it just has a command and a bunch of keywords, and then it will implement the things. It's the same as pulling down a dialog box and checking the various options. You can imagine if you have a data set of 5, 10, 100 subjects, it's going to be a lot easier to run a script than have to point and click your way through the whole thing. It's a nice way to generate code if you don't know how to program in this language. You can go through, and what you do is you just take this stuff and you copy it, and then you can paste it and generate your code for each subject. Okay. The history channel is closed. So, other things you'd like to see? Other questions about why we did what we did or what we're seeing here? Now, what I didn't do was re-reference. If I re-reference these data, we might see a very different pattern. CZ wouldn't look like such a dead spot. Obviously, some of this is an artifact of our reference. And it's an active reference, so we might actually want to look at a less active reference, like the linked mastoids, for example. Yes?
If you have a bad channel and you have to interpolate, how would you do that?
So you have a bad channel and you have to interpolate. What you can do is if you had, let's say we looked here and let's imagine that C2 was bad. Okay. One of the standard ways is to find the four nearest neighbors for C2. So that would be CZ, C4, and probably FC2 and CP2, although I'd have to verify that based on the CAP measurements. And you would use an inverse weighted average. So it appears, based on this, these are a little closer than these, for example. And what we might expect then is that these would be weighted a little more highly, these weighted a little less, and they would be normalized so that some of those weights is 1. And then what you would do is you would then estimate this channel to be the weighted sum of the four nearest neighbors. And in NeuroScan, that's accomplished using something called linear derivation, which is more than we need to go into now, but that would be the way that you do it. Okay. So those of you in the lab will have a chance to start playing with this with the data that you'll be collecting on yourselves. All right. Okay. So now we'll move on to talk about some applications. So this is still on the handout from last time, which was admittedly a bit overambitious in terms of handout. And an area where I've done some work and an area that generates a lot of interest is looking at asymmetrical patterns of brain activity over the frontal regions and how they relate to emotion and disorders involving regulation of emotion like depression and anxiety disorders. So historically, it was noted a long time ago from lesion data, from people who had naturally occurring lesions, that there was an asymmetrical impact of frontal lobe lesions. So in 1939, Goldstein talked about a catastrophic reaction that he saw in patients who had left frontal damage. And it was not seen to the same extent, if at all, in patients with comparable right hemisphere damage. In fact, patients with right hemisphere damage sometimes even showed kind of a lack of concern or something described as a belle indifference, or after the French, la belle indifférence. So they didn't seem particularly concerned about their condition. It was a fairly dramatic difference. Now, incidentally, later studies looked at this more carefully, trying to control for other confounds, and substantiated this pattern of findings. So for example, in most people, a left hemisphere lesion is going to be more likely to impact language than a right hemisphere lesion, or impact it more strongly, and that itself could be certainly more depressing and induce more dysphoric affect than a comparable right hemisphere lesion. But Robinson and colleagues, in a series of studies in the 80s, looked at trying to equate the amount of deficit and looked more carefully at the precise distance from the frontal pole, and they found that the closer a left hemisphere lesion was to the frontal pole, the higher the depressive severity, and the further the right hemisphere lesion was from the frontal pole, the more posterior it was, the higher the depression severity. So it was a different pattern of a relationship in the two hemispheres.
Wait, what was the first?
So if you have a left hemisphere lesion, the more anterior it is, the higher the depression. The closer to the frontal pole.
Okay.
And with the right hemisphere lesion, the further from the frontal pole, the more the depression.
Okay.
So you can think of a positive correlation if we're thinking, you know, going towards frontal pole as a higher number in the one hemisphere and a negative in the other.
Okay. But can you give, like, an example, I guess, like the system difference and things like that? Like, is the language, for example,
Well, in terms of these are in terms of emotion, so in terms of depression, looking at depression rating, catastrophic reaction, these patients would be prone to crying. They'd be less able to console themselves once they started crying. They would feel, you know, quite depressed and despondent about their condition.
Okay.
And the right hemisphere patients would, you know, be more of a, you know, no problem.
They'd be more like that
when it's close to so both of these describe what's like when those lesions are anterior, right? So that if you have a left anterior lesion, there's going to be a depressive, dysphoric, catastrophic reaction. If you have a right anterior lesion, it's going to lead to much less of an impact. In fact, perhaps kind of a lack of concern about the condition.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now, naturally occurring lesion studies are messy business because, you know, when people have strokes or other damage, this takes out large swaths of tissue. It's various across people. It affects fibers of passage. So it's obviously, you know, one method among many to try to hone in on this. So there have been a series of EEG studies looking at recording EEG, specifically over the frontal cortex, and then looking at the asymmetry in that, the left versus the right. And I'll talk a little bit more about exactly what that measure is in a bit. But looking at this literature of frontal EEG asymmetry, there are now probably pushing 100 studies, at least 50 of them looking at trait individual differences, for example, depressed versus non-depressed people, and another 30 looking at state manipulations, for example, when people are happy versus sad. And most of them support the theory, or most of them support the lesion findings. Okay? So just to give you, by way of overview, a sense of this, in terms of trait studies, there are studies that show that resting asymmetry, and by resting we mean just kind of what a person's EEG is like over the course of several minutes, maybe as many as 8 minutes, is related to other kinds of traits that differentiate people, like behavioral activation sensitivity. We'll talk about that a little more in a moment, but people with high behavioral activation sensitivity find a lot of things rewarding. They're driven to pursue rewards. They engage in activities just for the mere fact that they're fun. They're a kind of temperament that's going to lead them to engage with a lot of positive things in the environment, and you might think as being less prone towards dysphoric affect, and asymmetry relates to that. It's also related to psychopathology, for example, depression. I'll show you some of those data in a moment. And EEG asymmetry as a trait, as an individual difference, predicts how people respond subsequently. So, for example, I'll talk about a study in a little bit where infants are separated from their mom, and we can predict how they respond based upon their resting EEG, whether they respond dysphorically or they can be consoled more easily. So those are just some examples of the kind of paradigms, but they fall into three types. So they're related to other traits, they're related to psychopathology, or they predict emotional responses. But in each case, the EEG asymmetry is an independent variable here. It's an individual difference. Okay? There are state studies where EEG asymmetry is more typically treated as a dependent variable. So we look at state manipulations, and we see how EEG asymmetry may change. So based upon people's self-report, how they're experiencing things at the time, we may look at changes in asymmetry. We may look at asymmetry changing with changes in facial expression, and I'll show you examples of those kinds of studies as well.
Mm-hmm. What does BAS stand for again?
Behavioral Activation Sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. And those three things were traits that psychopathology states?
No, so there's three kinds of studies, right? In each case, EEG asymmetry is an independent variable. It relates to other traits.
Oh.
Relates to psychopathology, which you may or may not think of as a trait, right? But it's another individual difference. For some people, unfortunately, it becomes a trait.
And then the last is emotional response.
And the last is it predicts how people are going to respond emotionally, so it's kind of their characteristic response.
So it predicts state.
It predicts their state response, right. Okay. Now, all of this literature is predicated on an assumption about alpha versus cortical activity. So what this literature looks at is asymmetries in alpha power. And by inference, then the investigators talk about asymmetries in cortical activity. And we talked about before how, you know, the field does assume that when we have more alpha, we have less cortical activity, and vice versa. There was one study that tried to take a look at that pretty carefully. This is a study by Oakes et al. In 2004. Pete Zagalli is also on there. He's the author of one of the chapters that you read for the last class. And this diagram is showing us correlations. What we're plotting is the frequency of a given correlation. And the way the study was conducted is that subjects had simultaneous PET imaging, positron emission tomography imaging, and EEG. And so if there were some relationship between EEG activity and glucose metabolism, as indicated by PET, then we should see a correlation. Positive if it were the case that that frequency of EEG were indicating activity, or negative in the case of alpha if we were expecting that alpha is the inverse of activity. Now the way they did this involved trying to model the EEG not from the surface but actually down to voxels, which are little cubes in the brain, and comparing the EEG activity that was believed to be in that cube of brain tissue or generated from that cube of brain tissue with the glucose metabolism in that same voxel of brain tissue. So voxel by voxel, there's an EEG power and there's glucose metabolism. Okay? And so there's, you know, many, many voxels, as you can see. Brains have lots of voxels. And this is, and you can see a couple things. There's no kind of ubiquitous correlation for a given frequency band. But we look at alpha 1. Alpha 1 is lower alpha, about 8.5 to 10.5 hertz. It shows, I'm going to say, a median correlation, eyeballing, it looks like negative 0.33. Okay. So that's some evidence in support of this alpha is the inverse of activity assumption. When there's more alpha, there's a lower glucose metabolism in those voxels. Okay. But look at upper alpha, 10.5 to 13. Its median correlation looks like it's zero. So one thing this should tell us is that looking at 8 to 13 hertz across the board might not be defensible, or at least you shouldn't stop there. Unfortunately, most of the literature has stopped there. So I guess you could look at it, well, this is going to add noise, and this might be the real relationship here with lower alpha. Now, a lot of the frequency bands don't bear a strong resemblance to the glucose metabolism, but as we get out here into the higher beta and the gamma frequencies, now there's a median positive correlation. So higher frequency power is associated with higher glucose metabolism in those same voxels. Okay. So if I were looking just at this figure and didn't know much else, I'd say, well, I would be looking at alpha 1 and I'd be looking at higher beta and gamma activity as the best indicators of real, you know, brain metabolism. Because brain metabolism is not brain activity, but we also assume a tight correlation there as well. All right. So from here on out, I'm going to make the assumption everybody makes, which is when we're talking about alpha, we're talking about less activity. More alpha, less activity. And that will be the way we'll talk about most of the studies over the next several slides. Okay. So here's one of the earlier studies. The earliest study about depression with EEG asymmetry was actually done on a group of college students with high Beck depression inventory scores. But this study was done with diagnosed patients. This one was published in 1991 by Jeff Enriquez and Richie Davidson. So what we're looking at here is alpha power, and alpha power has been log transformed here because power values tend to be positively skewed, and so you'll see the log transforms used fairly routinely in this literature. And we see left alpha power and right alpha power. So in the depressed patients, we see more left than right alpha power. By inference, less left than right activity. Less left activity is like, you know, equivalent or analogous to the patients with left lesions. Right? So that's consistent with the lesion data. In the controls, we see a non-significant trend in the other direction. So they're more symmetrical, and if anything, going in the opposite direction. Okay? There are other studies that show this pattern with depressed patients. We did a small study of seasonal affective disorder. Ian Gottlieb did a study with depressed and previously depressed. Enriquez and Davidson did another study with previously depressed patients. The Schaefer et al. Study is the first study with the BDI-defined depressives. On the other hand, this study by Reed, Duke, and Allen didn't find this. This was a study that were the first couple of master studies to come out of my lab were not finding the effect, which was kind of depressing, but it has led to many citations because everybody says, oh, but also see them. But it has also led me to kind of look at this literature with a bit of a skepticism, which I'll share with you after I tell you the party line story. Yes?
Sorry. So decreases in alpha were increases in activation, so the control group was more activated. So for if you put the word anxiety instead of depression,
mm-hmm.
then what is...
Okay. Well, let me stop just a second. So I don't want to talk about this in terms of activation, okay? Because this is just a resting state, so it's activity. Now, unfortunately, much of the early literature talks about it as activation, which is borrowing from the neuroimaging literature, but that implies we activated people. So
okay.
This is just kind of baseline activity. So what it does suggest, though, is that these people have less left activity because they have more left alpha, okay? More right activity because they have less right alpha. If you look at anxiety, it looks much the same. But there's a complexity in that story as well. It's not all anxiety.
So are you comparing the depressed to the control, or just within the depressed to
the interaction here is significant,
yeah.
And this is significant, and that's, I believe, near significant. Yes?
Can you go over what you mean by left and right again?
What I mean by what?
The left and right variables in relation to alpha. Like, I know
sure.
you said it.
Okay, so we're just showing alpha power in the left frontal region.
Oh, okay.
And alpha power in the right frontal region. So if we have more left frontal alpha, we infer, because alpha is the inverse of activity, that there's less left frontal activity. Okay. Now, for... You can take sure. That's a great pause. Great pause. This is going to take a little bit anyway. All right. Now, keeping track left and right is sometimes kind of difficult, and also there are huge differences between people in the power at a given site, some of which are not really particularly relevant to what we're interested in. For example, skull thickness will have a large impact on EEG power. So somebody with a thicker skull is just going to have lower alpha activity overall than somebody with a thinner skull. So with those huge individual differences at any given site, what investigators have turned to doing is often looking at an asymmetry score. So you compare within a person left versus right. Okay. And so what we see here then is the difference between right and left alpha power, and of course it's been log transformed. So we have log right minus log left. And if you look at this, if you haven't seen this before, you have to think about it a second. So higher numbers are going to mean more right alpha. So higher numbers are going to mean more, by inference, left activity. Okay. Higher numbers, we infer more left activity. So this just shows from the Enriquez and Davidson study, the depressed subjects and the control subjects. Every subject is an actual circle here. There's clearly a mean difference. You can see there's a fair range of scores, but almost all the depressed subjects are below the control mean in this study. And a lot of the data that I'll show you will be based on asymmetry scores. Okay. Now, looking at this, there are a couple of ways to think about framing what this asymmetry means and what the difference in terms of the function of left and right frontal regions may be. And the two competing hypotheses that have been put forth and tested are a valence hypothesis and a motivational hypothesis. The valence hypothesis is kind of how I've described it so far. When you know things are good and things are positive, you show more left frontal activity, and when things aren't so good, they're negative, you show more right frontal activity. So depressed people look more right frontal, and high BAF people look more left frontal. All of that's kind of consistent with this idea of a valence explanation. An alternative explanation, though, is it's not about what one is feeling, but about what one is motivated to do. And this was an idea that was reformulated by Richie Davidson with respect to EEG asymmetry. And he talks about it as if left frontal systems subserve approach-related behaviors, or higher left frontal activity will be more likely that one is going to engage with and approach the environment, and right frontal activity might make it more likely that they would withdraw from the environment. Now, it's a nice hypothesis too, but you see these two things are typically hopelessly confounded, that when you feel good, you want to approach that thing, and when you feel bad, you want to get away from that thing. So one way to try to get at this is to look at an emotion that might separate these. And the idea that Eddie Harmon Jones had when he was working in my lab as a graduate student was, let's look at anger. Okay? So anger is a negatively valenced emotional state, but at least in some people at some times, it may make you approach the environment. Right? If I'm mad at you, and I could walk away, but oftentimes people don't do that, even though they should. Right? They stay engaged. Right? Road rage being kind of the worst possible case of behaviorally engaged negative affect. So if we could find a group of people who would experience anger and likely do so in a way that would engage them, then this would provide a test between the hypotheses. So people who are higher in anger, if valence is correct, they should be more right frontally active. If motivation is correct, they should be more left frontally active. So Eddie was working on these ideas here, and he went off to a postdoc at the University Medical Center at Galveston, working with a bunch of disturbed adolescents and adolescent boys, who I think when they experience anger are particularly likely to be approach related, right? They don't know when to kind of give up on the target of the anger. And so we looked at their scores on a scale of anger and aggression, and we correlated that with asymmetry scores. And this is what we find. We find a robust positive correlation with EEG asymmetry and aggression scores, or anger scores. It's an anger aggression scale here in the left frontal, or the frontal region. So these are asymmetry scores. Higher numbers on this asymmetry score reflect greater left activity. Higher numbers on the self-report measure reflect greater anger aggression. So the positive correlation favors that left frontal activity is associated with anger aggression. So going back to the previous one, that would favor the motivational hypothesis, right? Because anger would look like an approach-related emotion, and left frontal activity would relate to approach-related behaviors. Excuse me. Okay. Now, Eddie Harmon Jones has gone on to do a series of studies looking at situationally induced anger, which might be a more tightly controlled manipulation. So people say they're angry, but there might be other things that differ about those people. So would situationally induced anger relate to left frontal activity? And so Eddie Harmon Jones brought people in with a cover story. He had two perception tasks, a person perception task and a taste perception task. And so during the person perception task, each participant writes an essay on an important social issue, or sometimes it's on an issue like a potential tuition raise at the university. And then another ostensive participant, but actually just a made-up participant or a confederate of the experiment, gives them written feedback, both in terms of numeric rating and some comments, okay? And that feedback can either be neutral or insulting. So if it's insulting, they get negative ratings. They say, I can't believe an educated person would think like this. I hope this person learns something while at the University of Wisconsin, which is where Eddie was at the time that he ran the study. So, you've just written your essay. Presumably, you've put some effort into it. And this is the feedback you get back from the other participant. They say, okay, now we're done with the person perception task. Now we're going on to the taste perception task. And by the way, they but between these two tasks, we just want to get some baseline readings, so they record EEG while the person either in the neutral condition sits there or in the insult condition probably is getting kind of agitated and stewing about the feedback. Mm-hmm.
What did the participant think then was the point, I guess, well, they getting feedback from like?
They want to see how people perceive them, so it was a person perception task. How do people perceive?
Oh, I know, yeah, like, I know what the experiment said, but mm-hmm. what did the people on the participant think?
Oh, well, they thought that they were going to give their essay to another person and the other person would evaluate it as part of the person perception.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah. It's just there wasn't really another person. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they get their EEG recorded either while they're in presumably a neutral mood or a somewhat irritated, agitated, angry mood. And then they come to the taste perception task where the participant selects a beverage for the other participant so the experimenter can remain blind to the type of beverage. Now, most people don't question, you know, whether experimenters could figure out some other way to blind this, so they they go right along with it. So the idea is now I get to choose the beverage because the experimenter, if they chose it, they would know what the person what was chosen for the person. And there's six beverages to choose from in terms of pleasant or unpleasant and different in strength. So there's sweetened water of different intensities and including water with Tabasco sauce of different intensities. And that's their behavioral operationalization of an aggression measure. So you can see here, they're offering, you know, here's sugar and salt and there's Tabasco sauce on that one. And there are different concentrations as you go by. And so he's explaining to him that he walks out of the room and the person's supposed to pour into the cups a certain amount of the beverage, right? So they can detect, you know, what beverage was chosen and how much of it. So the most aggressive thing would be to take this, you know, a Tabasco and just fill the cup with this stuff, okay? So that's their measure. So, looking at the neutral people in the neutral condition who weren't insulted and people in the insult condition, we see a couple of findings. So, left frontal activity, these are standardized scores across everybody, and this is an asymmetry, or just left front, yeah. I think it's asymmetry score. So you see that compared to the neutral condition, people in the insult condition show a much bigger left frontal activity, positive numbers on this scale. They show more self-reported anger, and they also exhibit more aggressive behavior as operationalized by getting more hot sauce. Okay. But the interesting question is whether the EEG may actually relate to the extent to which they feel angry and the extent to which they aggress. And in the neutral condition, there was no relationship between asymmetry and anger and asymmetry and aggressive behavior. But in the insult condition, there was a strong positive correlation between EEG asymmetry and anger, more left frontal activity, more experienced anger, and more EEG asymmetry and more aggressive behavior. Note, these are partial correlations that adjust for baseline individual differences in asymmetry and in affective measures. So it should be due to the manipulation, or at least that variance that's accounted for by the manipulation above and beyond that accounted for by baseline differences. And this just shows you one of the the scatter plots. This is left frontal activity related to anger. So you can see the relationship there. More left frontal activity, more anger.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what was the anger measure based on?
It was a self-report scale, and I don't remember right off the top of my head what one they used. Yes?
Did you say that for depression patients, they were more like they have left?
No, more like one of them have more right frontal activity in depression.
Oh,
okay. Mm-hmm. Now it's hard to keep straight, the lefts and the rights and the different groups. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Now, so we're still working under this framework of approach withdrawal, and I'll talk about one more set of studies before we take a break. So if that's the case, we saw anger may be an approach-related emotion, and that seems to go along with left frontal activity. Other kinds of approach-related emotions go along with left frontal activity. So might people who are high in this behavioral activation sensitivity that I talked about also be likely to show left frontal activity? So I talk about this as a system that has three names because the name of the system may depend on the author. Behavioral activation system, or behavioral activation sensitivity, is talked about by Jeffrey Gray in animal models, and Carver and White developed a scale in humans. Behavioral facilitation system by people like Richard DePue, the approach system by people like Richie Davidson. I think they would probably have some issue with me lumping them all together, but there are substantial similarities between the different systems. And this system, this behavioral activation system, or people who are high in behavioral activation sensitivity, are going to be sensitive to signals for conditioned reward. They learn what things in their environment are likely to give them rewards. They also learn quite quickly what things are non-punishing in their environment, what won't cost them anything, and how to quickly escape from punishment. And this results in a driven pursuit of appetitive stimuli. These people are going to engage with positive things in the environment, seek them out, and pursue them. So they're high on appetitive or incentive motivation. Okay? So that's it's a motivational characterization of these individuals. This is what they're motivated to do. People who are low in behavioral activation sensitivity wouldn't be as driven towards these appetitive stimuli and wouldn't be as geared up by the possibility of rewards. And theoretically, anyway, a few authors, Richard Depew, Bill Iacono, Don Fowles, have talked about people who are high in behavioral activation sensitivity would be thought to be less likely to get depressed. Okay? So when setbacks occur, if you're high in behavioral activation, you may seek out other things that are rewarding, pursue them, and continue to pursue those as opposed to kind of stopping, withdrawing, and potentially feeling depressed. Okay. So in the study I'm going to show you next, we're looking at the correlation between self-reported behavioral activation. It's a scale by Carver and White, higher scores representing greater behavioral activation sensitivity, and for EEG asymmetry scores. And what we can see is positive associations, meaning greater left activity, greater behavioral activation, across a broad range of the frontal and even into the central region of the cortex, but nothing significant. Well, you could always wish that weren't there, but it's there. But certainly not the same pattern overall towards the back of the head. Okay. At the time we published this one in 1997, there was another one much like it by Steve Sutton and Richie Davidson, and then we subsequently replicated it in 2003. So it's a finding that we found several different times. Okay. So greater relative left frontal activity, greater behavioral activation. Okay, so before I summarize this a little bit, why don't we go ahead, let me see if there are any questions, and then we'll go ahead and take our break. Okay. All right. Any questions before we continue? Okay. So we're in the middle of this left and right thing. So left greater than right activity, which we infer by right greater than left alpha, which is always an asymmetry score, almost always an asymmetry score, then characterizes, as we've talked about, an approach-related motivational style. And I showed you some of those data with the behavioral activation scale. There's another study that looks at just higher trait positive affects, people who report, you know, on a trait basis, being more enthused and energized and happy and interested. These kinds of people also show greater left than right frontal activity. I talked about higher trait anger. Didn't talk about this, but lower shyness and greater sociability, which is consistent with the general theme. So Lewis Schmidt, Nathan Fox, and some of their colleagues have looked at kids with extreme shyness, temperamentally inhibited kids who may be at greater risk for adult anxiety or depressive disorders. And again, they find a pattern that's consistent with this, that the kids who are more sociable and less shy, and more engaged with the environment, are going to have more relative left frontal activity. And in a couple of studies also found that it may be associated with greater defensiveness. Defensiveness is a psychological construct where people would deny experiencing or feeling much in the way of negative affect. And it's not just that they may think that they're kind of fooling you. They may also kind of deny it to themselves. And so this would be psychologically potentially adaptive. You know, so you have some setback and you just don't really focus on anything negative, don't feel anything negative. It might, in fact, lead one to experience less propensity for depression. It might not be particularly healthy in other regards, right, if you're not dealing with things that are going on. This literature is a little more complicated. There might be some gender differences, So I would take that one a little bit more tentative, a little more tentativeness. Now, switching around, right greater than left activity, or left greater than right alpha, characterizes people with depressive disorders and risk for depression. I've talked about most of these studies. So it includes people who are currently depressed compared to people who have not been depressed, and people who once were depressed but are currently feeling well compared to never depressed controls, with the exception of the Reed, Duke, and Allen study that I also mentioned. But it's not specific to depression, so a few studies have come out looking at anxiety and certain anxiety disorders. Those particularly characterized by anxious arousal may also show a similar pattern of frontal EEG asymmetry. So the Davidson, Marshall, Tamarkin, Henrique et al. Study looked at social phobics awaiting giving a speech in front of other people. So they had to prepare their speech, and now they're waiting to give that speech. And, you know, nobody likes to do that, especially people with social phobia. And they record their EEG during that time. I think the title of the paper was Wallophobic Waits. And they found EEG asymmetry that looks in the same way as you'd experience with depression. So it may not be a specific marker, but tap a more general propensity towards emotional dysregulation. Okay. So, we've got a lot of correlations. These kind of people have this kind of brain activity. People with this kind of brain activity have these kinds of traits. But, of course, correlation is not causality. So we had an idea to try to manipulate frontal EEG asymmetry through biofeedback to see, could we do it? And if we did it have any emotionally relevant consequences? So this study was a study that brought INDV 101 students in for 5 consecutive days. We didn't use a full cap. We just had a small montage of F3, F4, CZ, and ocular lead. And we had 18 subjects total. 9 subjects were trained to increase left activity, and 9 were trained to increase right activity. So increase left relative to right, increase right relative to left. And the way this worked is that, first of all, subjects had a baseline period where they sat for 5 minutes. And we recorded the EEG asymmetry, and they had 1-second epochs. So across 5 minutes, there were 300 1-second epochs. And we could calculate the asymmetry score epoch by epoch. And it would have a mean and a standard deviation. And this was the first time I really saw how dynamic EEG asymmetry is. So at baseline, these people are about 70% of the time they're relatively left active compared to right. About 30% of the time they're relatively right active compared to left. So it's not a static system. It's not like 100% of the time they're this way. Now everybody had a mean and a standard deviation, and then we set a criterion that was 1 standard deviation above or below their mean depending which direction we were going to train them. Above their mean if they were trying to move to be more left active, and below their mean if they're going to try to move to be more right active. It's just the asymmetry score. So that criterion then gets titrated after each 5-minute block of training. So it starts there, and then they do a block of training. We calculate mean and standard deviation, adjust the threshold, do it again. And so throughout the session, they had 6 5-minute blocks. That criterion was always moving to always keep them trying to move their asymmetry. And they heard tones every time they crossed the threshold. Well, actually, they heard tones all the time. They heard high tones when they crossed the threshold and low tones at all other times. So if you're a subject in the study, it's an exciting prospect like this. Boo, 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 bee, boo, bee, boo, boo. And that's what they're doing for 5 minutes. And then, okay, let's take a break. And quickly, everything gets calculated, and we reset the threshold, and away we go again. The only time that anything different happened to that was when they made large eye movements, and then the tone stopped altogether. So, you know, boo, 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 boo. And pretty quickly people learned that we didn't tell them what was going on, but they learned not to move their eyes or blink too much. And we just told them, try to keep the high tone on as much as you can. If you start doing well, we're going to make it harder for you, so don't worry if it doesn't seem like you're getting more high tones across blocks. Just do what you can to get the high tone on as much as you can. Now, before the very first set of training trials and after the very last set of training trials on day 5, so before the first one's on day 1 and before the last one's on day 5, we had films that had been rated by other subjects at another university to elicit happiness, sadness, or relative lack of emotion. So they were film clips from Officer and a Gentleman when he reunites with the girlfriend, when he finds his buddy dead, and then there was some kind of nature film about flowers or something like that. All right. So that's the design. So first of all, we did find that we could manipulate asymmetry scores. So everything here is presented relative to their baseline session on day one. So you can see on day one, they don't deviate very much from zero. There wasn't a lot of change. But people trained left and trained right, then you can see changed overall in the predicted direction. Day one, there wasn't a significant change. If anything, it was in the wrong direction. But day two, three, and four, you see people who are trained left tend to start to increase this asymmetry metric. Remember, the symmetry metric means more left activity with higher scores, and people trained right tend to decrease it, and they were significantly different on days three and four. Day five, everybody kind of regressed back to the mean, and our best explanation for that is probably that these were consecutive days, starting on Monday or Tuesday, ending on Friday or Saturday. Yeah, Friday or Saturday may not be a day of peak motivation for our undergraduate population. I don't know if that would, you know, correspond with your experience. So we did show that EEG asymmetry appeared to be manipulated through these tones. Okay. Experimenter was blind to condition, so that shouldn't be an issue. Okay. Now, looking at before the training started, there were no differences in emotions on any of the films. They rated seven different emotions to the films. So here we see, however, differences after training for the happy film. So people trained to increase left frontal activity, more approach motivation, show greater interest, amusement, and happiness than do people who were trained right. And there weren't any differences in these negative emotions. There were patterns generally consistent with this finding for the sad film and the neutral film. You know, nobody felt much of anything, okay? But this was the only one that was significant. Now, we also looked at EMG activity, and I showed you this when we were talking about EMG activity here, just as a measure that's less susceptible to self-report, you know, biases or any kind of expectations of the subject if they generated any. And what we see is that subjects trained right, we think less behaviorally active, less behaviorally engaged, more depressed, more distressed, they show a decrease in zygomatic smile activity as a function of training. Whereas people trained left to increase behavioral activation, should increase positive affect, show a decrease in corrugator. And these were across all three films. So while they're watching the three films, there were no difference that interacted with this across film. I mean, the films differed from each other, but they didn't interact with training group. So there was a main effect of film, which I'm not showing here, a main effect of training group on each muscle group. So it appears we can manipulate asymmetry. It seems to have some subjective impact on how they rate the films, and it also seems to be impacting how they express their emotions during those films.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, with the training. So, mm-hmm. With the less you train people to increase, like, their positive things, how did you do it?
And then, well, we told them to use whatever strategy they could figure out.
Mm-hmm.
There was one study that looked at giving people some suggestions, like, you know, feeling certain things, and they found, and they had a group that they gave suggestions and didn't give suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
The group that was uninstructed was able to change asymmetry. The group that was instructed could not. So I think it must differ by person, and they need to figure it out. If you ask these subjects what they did, they'll tell you they don't know.
Right.
Many of them have a subjective sense they weren't doing much at all. I mean, they didn't feel like they had a lot of control.
So when you tell them to train their right, you tell them to increase their negative aspect.
We didn't tell them that. That's what you'd do if you're trying to give them a strategy. We gave them no strategy based on that other paper.
Mm-hmm.
The authors of which I'm forgetting now. But
so try and do it.
To keep the high tone on as often as possible. It didn't matter what group they were in. You know, we didn't have to give them a strategy because their strategy would be determined based on what they saw as producing the effect.
Okay.
And the feedback is always 1 second delayed from the brain activity. So we look at the FFT for a second, and then the tone comes on 1 second after that. So, you know, they're kind of trying to learn what they just did.
I'm wondering, this diagrammatic result here.
Mm-hmm.
So the right, people trained right before they did the training, that Z score indicates that they had a lot of tension.
They had more activity in the zygomatic before than after. Now, these are all Z scored within subjects. So you can't necessarily compare this to infer that there's more absolute activity in this group, but it The within subject pattern here is they decrease, and they don't decrease very much.
So they decrease the tension in their zygomatic muscle after the training. So they were trained more right.
Right. So they're trained in the direction we'd expect to be consistent with dysthymic affect, depression, and they show less smile. Well, less muscle activity.
Oh, less muscle activity.
When you, right.
Oh, okay. Not more tension. They're like becoming almost apathetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So less EMG activity in the zygomatic muscle.
Okay.
Okay. So that kind of thinking, well, maybe, you know, this could be part of a line of research that could actually have some translational impact. So we demonstrate that manipulation is possible. We demonstrated that it had some emotion-relevant consequences. So might it produce some clinically meaningful effects? So, and if so, then could we conduct an efficacy trial? So we had a case study, and this woman came in, and we're measuring her depression severity using a weekly measure, the Beck Depression Inventory that self-reports, and a measure every 3 weeks using a clinical interview, the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale. You can see those, you know, correspond pretty well to each other. So she comes in depressed, and like many studies, people immediately get better as soon as they get in the study. Just knowing they're in a study doing something is beneficial. And then people get a little disillusioned that things don't happen as quickly as they want, and then eventually some change ensues. That's not an uncommon pattern. So this looks promising, but it doesn't say, you know, EEG asymmetry was at play here. You know, she came in every day, she met with Maria Nazarian, the graduate student research assistant who was running it. You know, there are lots of other factors other than the biofeedback that could be responsible here. But anecdotally, she loved the tones. She wanted to go home with a tape of the tones. She didn't connect that they weren't any longer connected to her brain activity. She just learned to like the tone. And she was doing well at 3 and 6 months later. So this encouraged us to bring in a few more people. So we had a pilot trial. Now, these pilot trial of 5 people came from about 12 people, so the dropout rate is substantial in this. But again, based both on the Hamilton and the Beck, scores tend to go down over time using this training. They came in 3 times a week for 12 weeks, and you always, the way we mark this is at the end of a week, so week 13 is the end of the 12th week. So again, people on average are getting better, but the dropout rate is substantial. So we thought we'd plan a big trial, randomized control trial, where we'd actually try to tease apart whether or not EEG asymmetry changes are driving the symptom changes. So we proposed to get 18 to 60-year-old people recruited through newspaper ads, looking at treatment for depression, but we don't mention biofeedback, and we diagnosed them with major depressive disorder. And the design of this study was using a contingent and non-contingent yoked partial crossover design, which means, in essence, that people either get feedback that's meaningfully related to their brain activity. The feedback is contingent on their brain activity. That's everything you've seen so far. Okay? And there's non-contingent yoked feedback where tones are presented that another subject heard but aren't connected to this subject's brain activity. So for every subject that goes through, we got a record of all the tones that they heard, and then we can get those played back to this subject. And to make it believable, both people did have contingent timeouts for ocular movements. So even if they're in this group and the feedback's non-contingent, if they do blink or move their eyes, the tone goes off and they can learn to control that, so they feel like they have some control. So if this is the case, both people come in, they engage in a treatment that, you know, they might believe is going to be effective. They realize that some things they do have immediate consequences, like when they blink or roll their eyes, the tones go off. But only this group is getting feedback that should help them alter brain activity, and not this group. Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't understand the non-contingent yoked part. Like, what do you mean? Why are you using other people's?
Well, because I'd like to know that if this group gets better, it could be because I changed their brain activity. It could just be because they came in, they believed we had a good treatment, they got out of the house 3 times a week, they interacted with a research assistant, the tone seemed like a plausible change agent, and they had a placebo response. This group gets everything except the tones can't change brain activity.
Oh, it's a control.
It's a control group. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's a crossover design only because these people after 12 weeks then would cross over. So that's the big design. Okay. And again, or actually after 6 weeks, I'm sorry. So treatment three times a week per week for 6 weeks, and then the crossover. So this group gets another 6 weeks. This group gets another 6 weeks, but a contingent biofeedback. Okay. And so the results on this never materialized. We tried. We recruited over 20 people. We managed to get a few of them through. The dropout rate was 70-some percent in this study. And I should say, I've run other trials of depression where the dropout rates I've had have been in the order of 13% and under 10%. So the industry standard here is about 33%. So in my other trials, one offering acupuncture as a treatment for depression, and one making them come in four times for EEG before we offer them Lexapro for depression, we've had very low dropout rates. This treatment, there's something, I don't think it's just the RA, because she was really, really nice. There's something about this treatment that really isn't very effective. Well, it doesn't seem very helpful to depressed people. And as I think about it, it may be because in order to get people to move, you can't give them feedback too often. Right? They have to move from their own baseline. They have to get above some threshold to get positive feedback. Because of that, a majority of the tones are going to be the non-reinforcing tone. So for everybody, that's a little frustrating. But if you're depressed, it just feeds into the depressive syndrome. I'm worthless, I'm not efficacious, this is hopeless, I can't do this. I had one guy, when he was ready to drop out, I would talk to each subject, and he goes, I'm in the placebo group. I said, well, I don't know if you're in the placebo group, because I haven't looked, and I shouldn't know that. Why do you think you're in the placebo group? I can just tell I'm in the placebo group. You know. And this guy's whole approach to life was, I'm in the placebo group. I mean, he really was, it was all of the depressive symptoms coming out. You know, he was hopeless, he didn't feel like anything was working. And, you know, we talked for a long time. I said, would you like to try it another week and just see what, you know, how it's going? And he ultimately decided he didn't want to do it. And so later that night, I go and break the blind. He was in the active group. But, you know, patients just don't have a strong sense that they're really doing something. They don't have a strong sense of control over this. So I don't think the whole line of work is dead yet, but I think we need to get a little more creative about how we can, you know, make this seem like depressed people are having an impact on something. And so I'm not sure how to do that in a way that still help them change their brain activity.
Mm-hmm. For the subjects that did complete the treatment, descriptively, did their results look similar to that?
To the pilot trial? Yeah, they did. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have enough subjects to look at a mediation. There were some kind of inconsistent patterns, but with only a few people completing the treatment, you know, it just wasn't enough to look at whether or not it really mediated the outcome.
How long would you expect something like this to last?
It's hard to say. You know, we don't have any data about that.
I mean, wouldn't there be like, it's just training, you know, and you feel like 2 years without this reinforcement? I don't know, I just think that they would be where they were.
Well, many treatments require some kind of continuation or maintenance, and so you might expect that if they're going three times a week, then you taper off to one time a week, and then maybe one time a month. And then if symptoms get worse, you try to do something else, because all this presumes that it's effective in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could connect the tone to some kind of computer game.
Mm-hmm.
So that both groups are doing something, and the tone for one group would be connected to the brain activity, and another, but both groups are doing something.
Right.
So they think that they're in the active group, and they're getting some kind of mild positive reinforcement.
Right. Something has to. You have to get mild positive reinforcement that still in some way is contingent on their brain activity, or otherwise they won't learn to change brain activity either. So, yeah, we're still thinking about it. The project's just waiting to happen. If anybody wants to help out, so. I'll tell you one other anecdote about this that was really interesting. So during this study, we were training research assistants, and Maria, the graduate RA on the project, on more than one occasion had to volunteer her head to be hooked up so that she could train the RA. And this particular time was around lunchtime, and she had a bag of chips like this. And she was hooked up, and she would take the chip, high tone, low tone. High tone, high tone. We didn't replicate that, but I think that would be a very interesting study to do. But it's an anecdotal observation for what it means, but it was pretty provoking. Okay. All right. Let's look at a different manipulation. Eddie Harmon Jones and some of his students, he's now at the University of Texas A&M, Texas A&M University, looked at using hand contractions as a way of increasing frontal alpha. Now, I don't know that it's going to be kind of the same mechanism, but he does find, and there's small literature to support, that if you, you know, repeatedly make these strong hand contractions, and they weren't rhythmic, they were just a strong, sustained hand contraction, on the left side you'll increase relative right, on the right side you'll increase left frontal activity, and vice versa. So he did this to activate premotor cortex, and then he used the same kind of insult about an essay paradigm that he's become famous for. And this time, instead of hot sauce, they let people give an aversive noise blast to the person who insulted them. Okay. Yeah, Eddie is a devious researcher, and I like that. And his hand contractions altered frontal asymmetry as predicted. So left hand contraction, right hand contraction, greater left frontal activity. And it altered subsequent aggression in terms of noise blast duration. So the, and the asymmetry itself predicted the aggression. So here we see the length of noise given to the other subject as a function of your frontal asymmetry score during hand contractions. So people who could have the highest asymmetry score during hand contractions gave the largest noise blast. So again, it's still on the theme of aggressiveness and anger being approach-related, and greater left frontal activity promoting greater aggressive behavior. Mm-hmm.
So the thing that confused me about this is that, so when you're squeezing with your hand, you're activating the motor,
mm-hmm.
and he's saying the premotor cortex is where it's getting frontal activity.
Yeah.
So why would that, why would you,
right.
a motor,
just a simply motor activity,
have anything to do with aggression, even, I mean, just because it's in the right kind of fear?
Yeah,
I
admit that's a little bit of the black box on this. If it were more of a coordinated hab movement, you could make a case, well, you're going to need premotor programming in order to, you know, sequence that. But this is a fairly simple task, so I'm not quite sure, unless it still requires some kind of you know, coordinated, intentional activity that would be prefrontal in nature. It's a paradigm that's been used in social psych to activate left and right hemispheres, and they find changes in attitudes and beliefs and things consistent with left and right activity, so that's where he got the idea from, but I admit the anatomical specificity is not exactly what you'd like to see. Okay. So let's turn and talk about state changes. I mean, that was actually a state change there, but it was a manipulated change. So going back to some of the earlier studies, infants are a nice group to look at, because if you can see things in infants, it might suggest that, you know, this is present very early in life, before a lot of learning happens. And so, in a stranger mother paradigm, see this one? Oh, okay. I wonder why that's under state changes. This is a trait predicting a state change. I'm sorry that it sits here. This is the finding that I mentioned briefly, that infants who show greater right activity at rest are less consolable and more dysphoric when separated from their mothers. So it's the stranger separation paradigm. Mom leaves the room, nobody comes in right away, infant starts fussing, then a stranger comes in, infant really fusses, and you can predict the extent of that reaction based upon resting activity. And resting in infants isn't really just sitting quietly. They put them in one of those little cars and they have an EEG cap and they're going to follow them around and throw out 90% of the data because it's a mess, and keep 10% of the data, and then they categorize them as relative left frontal active or right frontal active. Okay. Now, a state change, a true state change, is they looked at very young infants. These were, I think, only days or weeks old. And they gave them sucrose and water. In fact, they also gave them lemon as well, thinking lemon would be sour and kids wouldn't like that, and sugar would be sweet and they'd like that. Well, these guys apparently didn't have kids at the time. Kids love lemon, right? So lemon didn't pan out as predicted. But they showed when they gave the kids sucrose, they showed a relative shift towards left frontal activity. When they gave them water, that was an unpleasant surprise, I guess, compared to the lemon and the sucrose, they showed a shift towards right frontal activity. They showed infants looking at actresses on a video screen showing different facial expressions, and so the actress looking right at the camera makes, you know, smiles and makes fear faces, and infants, of course, will start to mimic this and kind of start to take on some you know, characteristics of the emotion. They may be kind of content during the happy phase and kind of a little fussy during the fear phase. And again, they show changes in EEG symmetry consistent with that. So relative left frontal activity for happy and relative right frontal for fear. Okay. There's a study with primates that I threw in here. It's not really consistent necessarily with the motivational model, but is with the affect model, that benzodiazepines, which are going to make people feel less negative for the most part, I guess there's a dose response issue here, but you know, with a modest dose, are going to feel less negative affect, and they show an increase in left frontal activity in the primates. Mm-hmm.
How do they recruit
like
populations for that stranger mother? Like, what kind of mother comes in and
says,
"I'll walk out of the room"?
Well, they know it's for science, and they know it's brief lived, brief, you know, brief in duration. Well, they get people to do it. That's a good question. I don't know how many people would refuse to do it. Mm-hmm. And these are all, you know, infant mother paradigms, just based on base rates of who's going to spend more time with the kid. But I don't know what they do in cases where the father is the primary caretaker either. I suspect it could relate to attachment style in adults, but I don't know that that was assessed in the study. I don't remember. That's a good question. Okay. Now, state changes in adults, there are several different kinds of studies here. In several studies, they looked at spontaneous expressions of emotion while people are looking at films for the most part. And they find that when people show spontaneous expressions of joy, they show an increase in left frontal activity. Okay. In fact, in the, I think it was the Davidson et al. 90 study, they showed films and across the entire film, there was no difference in EEG symmetry between a happy film and a sad film. But if they went back and looked only where people were spontaneously showing expressions of emotion that were consistent with the film, then they pulled out the effect. So it seems that when they're experiencing the target emotion, you see the changes. Now, it raises the issue that maybe EMG is bleeding into the alpha band, and that could be a confound. I'll talk about that in just a minute. We took a look at this. Jim Cohn and I and Eddie Harmon-Jones looked at directed facial actions. So this is where we ask people to make facial expressions of emotion without telling them that that's what we're up to. So our cover story was, you know, we record EEG all the time in this lab, but there are all these muscles on the face, and we really don't know what happens when these muscles are active. It could be influencing our reading. So we're going to ask you systematically to move different muscles. We're going to ask you to move those muscles and hold them so we can see what the impact is on brain activity. So we build it as kind of a methodological artifact study. It was deception in one way, but not in another. We did want to see what impact it had on the brain activity, but not necessarily as an artifact. So we told people to do things like, you know, bring the inner corners of your eyebrows down and together, you know, and so on. So those of you who've been in my lab have seen this task in action, and people then have these expressions. This is a complicated graph, but you can see that all three panels look fairly similar. Each panel is a different reference scene. If we just look here, for example, at the average reference, these are faces that we would characterize as withdrawal faces: fear, sadness, and disgust. The white are faces we would characterize as approach faces, that's anger and happiness. And then the black are just partial faces that aren't a real face. It's just the single muscle being pulled. So we have sadness, fear, and disgust, happiness, and anger, and a couple of control faces. And what you can see is that the withdrawal-related faces show alpha asymmetry shifts to more right activity compared to the other faces. We didn't get a robust shift in the other direction for the approach-related faces. And we would have predicted that. We didn't get that one to come out. These are three different frontal regions: lateral frontal, F7, F8, midfrontal, F3, F4, and a frontal temporal central site, which is kind of right here. So it's kind of in between these two and a little bit posterior. By comparison, we don't see any such effect in the parietal region, so it's a control, showing it's not the entire hemisphere. Okay. Now, we were worried about whether EMG directly was causing these effects, and so we assessed EMG on the frontalis muscle and looked at EMG activity. We also assessed EMG in a high-frequency band at each site, 70 to 90 hertz, assuming it wouldn't be brain activity, but would be EMG activity. we did all these analyses again, putting each of those in first as a covariate to try to suck up variance and see if we could make the effect go away, and the effect persisted. So we were reasonably confident that the EMG activity that's there wasn't producing these effects. And there was a lot of EMG. I mean, these recordings were very, very noisy. Okay. All right. So what's been of interest to me in the last few years is whether EEG asymmetry might serve as an indicator of risk for emotional disorders. And I put a question mark, acknowledging that it may not be specific to depression, but could be, you know, more generally a risk indicator for affective instability or affective problems. Now, if it's an indicator of risk, we'd expect it to be a stable trait of an individual. So we should see it in an individual across time. And we see interclass correlations suggesting that EEG asymmetry is fairly stable across 3 weeks in college students by Andy Samarkin, across 5 sessions across 2 years, again by Samarkin. We also see it from 3 months to 3 years by Nancy Aaron Jones. And in probably the biggest study, Dirk Hageman looked at 4 sessions across, I think, a couple months, and estimated about 60% of the variance to be stable trait variance. Okay. And we looked specifically in depressed people as to whether it would be stable. And so we had people in our acupuncture treatment study for depression have an EEG every month for 5 months. And some of them stopped after 3 assessments by design, others went on to 5 assessments. And you can see that these numbers bounce around a little bit, but again, about 60% of the variance seems to be stable trait variance. So that's pretty good for a trait, and potentially suggests this might tap an enduring characteristic of an individual, and potentially one that might signify they're in some way at risk for depression or anxiety. These are just these interclass correlations plotted on head maps. A lot to digest, but you can just see that they're fairly high across the board. A couple look a little lower than you might like, but overall they're reasonably high. That's across 3 assessments and 5 assessments, just using different reference schemes. So this is not a table that's obviously meant to be digested either here or especially on your handout, but it's a framework for how you think about this. So when we're looking at something like a psychophysiological measure and asking whether it could be an indicator of something about psychopathology, what kind of a marker it might be, it could be a marker of an episode, in which case it would come and go with the episode. You'd see it in people with the disorder and not people without the disorder. Okay? And it would change with clinical state. I've shown you some data already that suggests this doesn't change with clinical state, arguing against this being a episode marker. So a liability marker would characterize people with the condition and differentiate them from, say, non-depressed people in the case of depression. It would demonstrate stability in both groups, which I showed you that it does. And ideally, it would predict the future development of depression in people who are currently not depressed. Some data relevant to that, not with depression, but with kind of continuous measure of depression. Jim Cohen looked at incoming freshmen at the University of Virginia. He got a deal to run many of them through his EEG asymmetry lab. And he got EEG asymmetry. It was actually during a karaoke task. It's a task that makes people pretty uncomfortable. But people who showed left frontal activity during this socially challenging task had much lower depression over the ensuing semester than those who showed more right frontal activity during the task. So that suggests the possibility, anyway, that this is a liability indicator. The kinds of data that I've indicated with a bunch of footnotes here are fairly small samples, though, and we're running a big study now of over 300 people to try to test this more specifically, looking at currently depressed people, previously depressed people, but who are currently feeling well, and never depressed people. And then, so right now, evidence is favoring a liability perspective, but the data sets are small, and we'll have a more definitive answer probably by the summer. Liability indicators can result either from genetically influenced factors, or they might not be genetically influenced. So everything that I've said about a liability indicator would also be true of a genetic indicator, but it also should be heritable within the general population, and you should see it more commonly in people with a strong family history of depression. So in our large 300-person study, we're also taking family histories, and we'll be able to look, do people with a strong family history of depression who themselves have never been depressed show a pattern of asymmetry like depressed people? Okay. And this just shows, this is a very fun slide from a 1974 paper by David Licken and Alcatelligan and Thorkelson. And these are twins, monozygotic twins. So these are different pairs of twins. They're numbered pair 102, pair 323. And they're part of the Minnesota Twin Study. And you can see that twin A and twin B look very much like each other in their power spectra during resting EEG. But they don't look, you know, one twin pair looks quite different than another. But their spectra look very, very much the same. And the alpha power, of course, being a dominant feature of that in this plot. Asymmetry seems to be less heritable than this would imply. Asymmetry scores are probably heritable somewhere around heritability of 0.4 to 0.5, okay, as is much of psychology. Okay. So we've talked about this potentially a trait. About 60% of the variants might be stable trait variants. We've talked about changes in state, but there are also changes that go from one occasion to the next that aren't due to a manipulation, a state manipulation by the experimenter. But they still seem to be reliable variants. So there's three sources of reliable variants: stable trait consistency across assessments. That's about 60% of the variants. Occasion-specific variants. These are reliable variations across multiple sessions of measurement. They come in today. They come in next week. They come in next month. They may be different. It's somehow systematic but unmeasured causes of this variance. It might be the hassles that they've had recently, something we're measuring in our big study. It might be their current mood, although that probably doesn't seem to account for it in the things that we've looked at so far. It could be the interaction they just had with the experimenter in the lab. There have been some studies looking at sex of experimenter and sex of subject, for example. It could just be idiosyncratic things. You know, a person got a parking ticket on their way in. You just don't know, you know, exactly what this may reflect. And then there's state-specific variants where it actually changes with experimental manipulation that we talked about already. Now, if you exclude state-specific for a minute, we're just looking at, say, resting asymmetry. If 60% is stable, consistent variance, then the rest must either be error or occasion-specific fluctuations. In terms of the reliability, it's pretty high. It's over 0.9, maybe over 0.95 for EEG asymmetry, which would suggest then that occasion-specific fluctuations account for maybe 30 to 35% of the variance in EEG asymmetry, and we don't really have a clue as to what's driving those yet. Okay, so yeah, unreliability measurement is pretty small, and I'll show you that in a minute. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit more about the way some of the data in this field are processed, because I started getting curious about this as I was looking at, you know, our own lack of replication of one of the effects, but then a lot of the effects do come through, and starting to look at some of these assumptions and the way that we derive these metrics, the asymmetry metrics. And so what I'll present here comes from a paper that I wrote with Jim Cohn and Maria Nazarian in 2004, if you need to look at that for reference. Okay. So this is the basic data processing stream. Here we see we have EEG for about 10 seconds, and you know, we might have minutes of it. And ultimately, we want to have a power spectrum that reflects, you know, the characteristics of frequencies during that period of time. The way that we do that is we chop the data up into a series of overlapping epochs. So this epoch begins before that one has ended, and they often will overlap by 75% or so. And the reason that that's done is because the Hamming window weights points at the ends of the epoch less highly. And so if you didn't have overlapping epochs, you'd have data weighted heavily, not heavily, heavily, not heavily, heavily, not heavily. So if you want everything to be weighted, but still have the benefit of a window, you can create overlapping epochs. And what I did here was I just overlaid Hamming window functions, and then here's the net result in terms of the weight, that there's not much weight at the beginning, but then throughout, you know, a big duration of the epoch, and if this went on for a long time, things are weighted, you know, fully, and then there's a little taper at the end. This just shows what the Hamming window does to one of these EEG epochs. The gray line is the original waveform, and then applying the Hamming window, we get the black waveform, so you can see it really attenuates the fluctuations at the end of the window. And then for each one of these epochs, we create an FFT, and then all these FFTs are averaged together to get one summary spectrum. Okay, so each of these power spectra represents one epoch, and then we average them together to get the power spectrum across epochs, which was the last step that I did in the demo today, where I did the average in the frequency domain. And one of the things you see is that the alpha power spectrum varies a bit from one effort to the next, but it clearly emerges in the average. So that's the basic data processing stream. So there's some assumptions that we make along the way. We've talked about the alpha as the inverse of activity assumption, so I won't mention that one again. We often look at different scores, and we typically log transform them, as I mentioned. And it's usually log right minus log left. And here's another thing that will annoy you if you're getting into this field. The early papers say log, but they meant natural log, and I only found that out by talking to the investigators. So now the newer papers usually say natural log, but not always log. And sometimes people say log when they mean log 10, and sometimes people say natural log when they mean natural log. So it's a little annoying if you want to compare values across studies. But higher scores then reflect greater relative right alpha, and by inference, less relative right activity. Okay. Now, why would we do the natural log transforms? Well, everyone's doing it, but why does everyone do it? Because power values are said to be skewed. Well, are they really skewed? They are. The data are skewed. And skewness, if you don't have skewed data, then you have a skewness statistic of zero. And what we can see here is that the raw data tend to have positive skew, meaning that, you know, a bunch of people are kind of clustered at the low end, and there's a few people that just trail way out there at the high end. And so I looked at the skewness of the log transform data, and you can see it actually flips it towards a little bit of a negative skew. And this line just shows you what would be kind of a comparable amount of skew in the raw versus log transform data. So things above the line mean that the data were more skewed in raw than they were in log transform. So that's a pretty good result. Log transform resulted in less skew for most of the electrode locations here. Okay. We also looked at kurtosis. So a normal distribution is going to have a kurtosis of zero, and then if things are too peaked or too flat, you'll get kurtosis deviations. Again, things above the line suggest the data were more out of compliance with normal distribution before than after the transform. And if we just look at the sites deviating from normality in terms of skewness or kurtosis, it's a significance test. 94% of the sites had significant skew, and 83% had significant deviations from normality in terms of their kurtosis. And after the transform, those numbers were greatly reduced. Not eliminated, but greatly reduced. And in terms, those are the raw sites, and looking at asymmetry, it also improves things. So the asymmetry score kind of helps in that if somebody's a real kind of outlier on the distribution on one side, barring an artifact, they may also be on the other side. So looking at the difference between them, it may kind of take care of some of that. So only 67% of the sites showed significant skew before transform, but after it was down to 22%. And in terms of kurtosis, there was a similar improvement. So based on this, I'd suggest log transforming is probably a reasonable idea for the data. Okay. Now, one of the questions that people raise is it right or is it left? And going back to the approach withdrawal model, it's talked about, well, left is approach and right is withdrawal. That implies almost like, you know, the left is approaching and the right is withdrawing. But the asymmetry metric is always looking at the difference between them. So people have become interested in trying to assess left versus right activity. But because there are these huge individual differences in alpha power at any given site that are due to kind of irrelevant factors like skull thickness, that can be a problem. And you can assess it in ANOVA with hemisphere as a factor. So if you were looking for a difference in frontal asymmetry by in a feature of depression, you'd find a main effect of depression on an asymmetry score, or you'd find a depression by hemisphere interaction in an ANOVA that had hemisphere as a factor. Okay. And it removes overall power before testing for the interaction of that factor, like psychopathology, with the hemisphere. So that's a reasonable approach. But if you then want to look at the relationship of asymmetry with some continuous variable, like behavioral activation or continuous measure of depression severity, it's not easily amenable for that. So you might want to think about some other methods. So that's why asymmetry scores are often used. Now, the problem, as I mentioned, is that the power of an individual site, though, if you're trying to correlate that with something like depression severity or behavioral activation, reflects both underlying neural activity and other static irrelevant features like scalp thickness. Okay. Now, an early and non-optimal solution was one proposed by Wheeler and Davidson et al. In 1993, and they used a residualization procedure. So first of all, they residualized each site based on whole head power. So people had more power, that kind of got taken into account. And then we looked at deviations from what would be expected based on whole head power. And I think that's a reasonable
assumption. It's a reasonable approach. So people who have, for example, thin skulls will have more power everywhere, and you're just looking at deviations from the pattern. But they also then secondarily residualized a given site on the homologous lead's power. So F3 was then residualized on F4's power. And they said that this was because they were worried about volume conduction and things. And I think this is particularly troublesome, and I'll show you what led me to this. So these are some data I had from the behavioral activation study that I showed you. These are the correlations of asymmetry scores with behavioral activation under two reference schemes. And I applied that Wheeler-Davidson procedure, and I got this. So now what we see is that every correlation on the right side is very close in magnitude and direction to this correlation, and every correlation on the left side is close to being a mirror opposite. It's almost equal and opposite in magnitude, and that's true across here. And I tried this on another data set, and the same thing happened. I tried it on another data set, and the same thing happened. And it made me think that this probably wasn't the way that it was really working. There might be something at play. So why does it do that? That was my question. It actually results in correlations of the outcome variable similar in magnitude to the difference score, but with opposite signs for the two hemispheres. But I ultimately realized this is to be expected when left and right activity themselves are extremely highly correlated. So then I looked at what is the correlation between activity at the right lead and the left lead across people. These are astounding. Anything else in psychology correlated this highly, you know, you'd have a science paper. But this is the result of huge individual differences in irrelevant things, like scalp thickness, okay? So they're like 0.99, 0.97, 0.95, they're very highly correlated, the right to the left, okay? And it doesn't matter what reference scheme you're using. So then let's think about what's happening when we're residualizing the power at a site. So what happens when we're making a residual left power when the left is almost equal to the right, right? They're very highly correlated. Okay. So that procedure, ignoring the whole head residualization for a moment, now we're looking at residualizing based on the homologous lead. So the residual, the left residual, equals the actual value minus the predicted value for the left site. That's just what residualization is. It's the residual after you predict the left value. And that predicted left value is going to equal some offset and then some beta weight times the right activity, because the right is what we're using to predict the left. But when the right virtually equals the left, they're correlated 0.98, 0.99, then we can substitute in here instead. Well, there wouldn't be any offset, and the beta weight would be 1. So left is going to equal right. Okay? And then the residual is left minus the predicted value of L, and the predicted value of L is R, so left residual equals left minus right. So this is tautological. When they're this highly correlated, we're going to find that all of the left-sided values are now the opposite of the asymmetry score. And you can work this through for right, and they'll be the same direction as the asymmetry score. And so there you'll get the pattern that I showed you. The right side looks like the same magnitude and direction as the asymmetry score, and the left side is virtually the inverse. Okay? Thank you. Okay. So this is going to happen when your data are highly correlated like this. Okay? As I said, so the right values are going to be the opposite. They'll approach R minus L, and the left values will approach L minus R. Okay, so it'll make it appear then that there's this kind of, you know, difference. And most of the studies that did that found, oh, both hemispheres are contributing. But of course, this is just an artifact of this procedure. So my conclusion is, don't do that. All right. So now we go to the new handout. That's for you in class. If you're later watching this on the web, the web slides actually, they continued up to here too. That's right. And they started over. So if you happen to be watching just this lecture on the web, then the slides started earlier. But to save paper, you have to switch here in class. Okay. So if you can't do that, what should you do? Okay.
Well, you can residualize only on whole head power. That's not vulnerable to this same kind of artifact. But don't do it additionally on homologous lead power. That's a bad idea.
So why would you? So what you were talking about before, they still did residualize on the whole head power, but then they went on. Why would you residualize again? Like if you're doing one residual.
In the 93 paper, they said they thought about high degrees of volume conduction from the other hemispheres. They're thinking, well, maybe if this lead is picking up not only activity under it, but activity that's volume conducted from here, we should try to take that into account.
I didn't realize that like those would be highly correlated.
I don't think they really appreciated the problem with it. And when I first read it, I said, oh, that's a clever idea. And then it was only when I kept looking at my data coming up again and again and again with the same pattern that it just seemed kind of suspect. So that's a reasonable way to do it. Or, and this might be beyond where we can go with this class, but just to suggest an approach, is you could use some hierarchical general linear model where you can use both categorical and continuous predictors. And you put in hemisphere, you can put in reference scheme, all in a single model to predict what's happening. And we do that with the same data that I showed you with the BASC. We get a different pattern. So here was the data I showed you before, the asymmetry metric, the artifactual assignment to each hemisphere. When we did this instead, putting in F3 and F7 as left leads, and F4 and F8 as right frontal leads, we found, predicting BASC score here, that there is an asymmetry in this pattern, that it's actually the right frontal activity that's more strongly related to BASC than the BIS, or than the left frontal activity. Nothing happened with the BIS, sorry. So here, people who have greater right frontal alpha, less right frontal activity, have a higher BASC score. And the left frontal, actually, we would have predicted, going the other way. It didn't do that. It went slightly this way, but it was not significantly so. So the interaction is significant. This slope is significant. This slope is not. So the right hemisphere seems to be carrying the effect for the BASC activity here.
Mm-hmm. So to kind of channel AJ here, why would you choose to, alter your data by residualizing when you could just stick it out into a general linear model?
Right, right. So that's what I'm suggesting here to do, yeah.
Is there any advantage to doing the residual thing, or is it just something that people did before, the whole GLM thing?
I think it was an easier way for people to think about it initially, right? And also, if you do residualize on whole head power, you can do nice things like scalp maps that are going to be easier to do than this. But you can do a scalp map of beta wave feeding, so I still don't see that that's a limitation, or standardized beta waves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So no, you can channel AJ. That's an appropriate thing to do. Okay. Now, reliability of this measure was an issue for a while, and Tamarkin et al. Came out with a very nice paper in 1992 where they recorded 8 minutes of resting data, 4 with eyes open, 4 with eyes closed, and they reported the psychometric properties, and they were really good. And so every paper after that was kind of held to that standard. Do you have at least 8 minutes? If you have less than 8 minutes, that might be less reliable. So here we have Cronbach's alpha, a measure of internal consistency reliability. Mm-hmm. And the way that Tamarkin et al. Did it, and the way that I did it to show it here, was they took EEGA symmetry minute by minute. Now they have 8 items, if you will, on a scale. And you can think of it, the internal consistency reliability of a scale as looking at the degree to which those items hang together. And so instead of 8 items, they had 8 minutes. And they just calculated the internal consistency reliability of asymmetry scores. And you can see that, in our data here, they're reasonably high. They fall off here at the frontal pole, and that's probably due to ocular artifacts. But they're pretty good, through the rest of the frontal region and certainly in the posterior region. So they're highly reliable. Okay. But then I realized that this 8-minute thing confounds the number of items with the number of minutes. Okay. So if you've taken a psychometrics class, one way to make a scale more reliable is to throw a lot more items in. Okay? And if they're of comparable quality, you'll just start boosting the reliability just by having more items. Okay? So I thought, what if we took the same number of items but less data? So I have 8 recording minutes, and I could chop it up into 8 1-minute blocks. I could chop it up into 8 45-second blocks. I could chop it up into 8 30-second blocks and 8 15-second blocks. I could also do it in terms of 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2 blocks. Okay. So So now we can think, what matters more, the amount of data I record or the way I chopped it up to do this estimate? And what this shows is it's the way I chop it up to do the estimate. So this might be the clearest at this, but they all show a similar pattern that what we see is that the solid line is the standard way of estimating reliability, 1 second, 1 minute block, okay? And if we have 8 of them, 7 of them, or 6 of them, 5 of them, 4 of them, 3 of them, 2 of them, you can see the effect, you know, I guess this kind of got in the way, 8, 7, 6. So when you have fewer blocks, of course, it looks like you have lower reliability. But if I take, so if I look at 2 60-second blocks, it looks like my reliability is about 0.5. But if I look at 8 15-second blocks, my reliability is 0.7. That's the same exact data. But it's just, if you estimate it using this minute, confined to the minute, using the minute as the item, you're going to underestimate your reliability. So from this study, and one that Dave Towers and I are working on right now, probably with as little as 2 minutes of data, you can get highly reliable estimates of EEG asymmetry. That's 2 minutes of usable data. And if you've worked with these data, you'll see, you know, people move, there are discontinuities, there are muffle bursts, you get rid of data for blinks. So you might need to record more than 2 minutes, but it's not as bad as needing to have 8 minutes. One other issue before we leave the methodology here. Another thing that people have made a large issue of is matching the impedance of homologous sites. So when we record a signal, we reduce the impedance on the skin by abrasion. And of course, that impedance is going to limit the amplitude of the signal that we can see. And so it seems that all in all, it would be a good thing to match impedances on the two sides. And the standard people have usually used is less than 5 kiloohms impedance and no more than 1 kiloohm difference between homologous sites, which is, that's a pretty heavy-duty restriction. It's a hard one to meet. So I asked, how important is it to match impedances? And there are some formulae for determining, given the input impedance of an amplifier, what would be the amplitude of the signal you'd get, given differences in impedance. So I had a case where the right signal was actually 5 microvolts larger than the left, or it was actually 0.5 microvolts larger than the left, yeah. And I varied the impedance from 0 to 10 kiloohms on the left and the right, and then I looked at the log right minus left asymmetry score. These are really tiny font, but these planes are very, very flat. These had to be expanded just to even show it. They don't even differ to, I think, the fifth or sixth decimal point. So within any acceptable range of impedance, like less than 10 kiloohms, with like a standard GRASS or an earlier generation neuroscan amplifier, 10 or 20 megaohm impedance, it doesn't make any difference of consequence. And the new amplifiers that are out now are on the order of a gigaohm input impedance, and that would flatten this even more. So I think as long as you have all of your impedances less than 10 kohms, you should be in solid ground, and you can be freed from the laborious restriction that one be within 1 kiloohm of the other. Oh, and there's a, I don't know if it came out of your handout, there's a little formula that's in black that doesn't show up here that tells you how I calculated that. Is that on the handout?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. You can't read it there either. Okay. All right. If you want that formula, I'm happy to send it to you. Okay. All right. One other issue. Since we're looking at, you know, left minus right differences, could it just be that this is somehow related to overall power? And maybe the left power is more tightly coupled with overall power, or right power is more coupled with overall power? Well, one way to look at that is just look at the sum of left and right power and see if that's related to the difference score. And it's not. I looked at 11 different scalp regions under 3 reference schemes and looked at the correlation between total power and the difference score at that site, and 1 of 33 correlations was significant. You'd expect that, of course, by chance. So it didn't seem that that's an issue. And it might be because the logs actually have a built-in correction for power, because we're taking the difference of two logs, and if you remember back, or you're still in your memory, the difference of logs is actually the log of the quotient. So log right minus log left is like the log of right over left. So there's some built-in correction for overall power already. And just to show you that, another metric that people have used that obviously corrects for power is the difference over total power. And if you plot that against log right minus log left across a wide range of scores, you see around in the range that we're likely to see for asymmetry, that relationship is really nicely linear. So it clearly does correct for overall power using the metric that we're using. Okay. So, parting thought on asymmetry then. This asymmetry in emotion literature involves a collection of findings that converge despite a lot of differences. Differences in the way in which the data were recorded, differences in the manner in which the data were reduced. All those steps I showed you differ a little bit across different labs, and the manner in which they're subsequently analyzed. I didn't talk too much about the reference scheme. That's another difference in here that's quite variable across studies. And as I concluded in this paper with Jim Cohn and Maria Nazarian, I said that the optimist will see this as a testament to the robustness of the underlying systems reflected in the EEG asymmetry, and the curmudgeon will see this as representing considerable literature-wide alpha slippage due to the many permutations of data analysis and reduction. So I'll leave it up to you to decide if you're an optimist or a curmudgeon. I still fall somewhere in the middle on this point. Still a bit of a skeptic, but continuing to trudge on and study this phenomenon. Okay. Yes?
That earlier paper that you and your students did that didn't find a relationship between the status of symptoms and asymmetry, what do you wish you
did that for? We don't know. So there are a lot of things we looked at. This was two studies. One was BDI-defined college student depressives. The depressed group had scores that were consistently 16 or above on the Beck Depression Inventory, both at screening at the beginning of the semester and when they came into the lab sometime during the semester. And then the lows were below 6. The study 2, which was the other student's masters, were clinically defined DSM-3R, at that time diagnosed, major depressive disorder, free of any other Axis 1 psychopathology, and the controls for any psychopathology. We thought we had different ages in the two groups. We looked at, you know, was age in the clinical sample, which was a greater range, was it related? It wasn't. We looked at the actual constellation of depressive symptoms. If we take the approach withdrawal model, one might think that a withdrawn, anhedonic, hypersomnic, lack of appetite, depressive symptom picture might be this withdrawal style, and that should be related strongly to asymmetry. Individual differences on that, on a measure that we made of those kinds of symptoms also didn't relate. We were kind of left with a bit of an enigma, really. You know, we don't have any clear explanation for why it is, but we know it's there. And talking to people, there are some other studies out in the file drawers, you know, people failing to replicate, but there was a meta-analysis that appeared just this last year or the year before in Journal of Abnormal looking at this, and across not just depression, but depression and BASS and a couple of other measures, calculated the file drawer effect. It would have to be substantial. So, you know, the meta-analysis leads me to believe that there's something there, but there are clearly unaccounted for variables that are influencing asymmetry from one session to the next, and we just haven't accounted for it. You know, were our experimenters too friendly? Both students were very friendly. I just don't know how those things play out. Okay. Let me introduce just a little bit on a new topic. Well, it's still EEG frequency stuff. So this is the idea of synchronization and desynchronization, which is a terminology you'll see, but it's a little bit misleading. And it's started with alpha. And so the idea is that alpha blocking meant that the EEG had become desynchronized, because when there's more synchronous activity, it sums together to create larger amplitude alpha. And yet it's still highly synchronized. That's why it's a little misleading, right? That it's just not synchronized any longer at 8 to 13 hertz. It's synchronized at some other higher frequencies, for example. So it might involve fewer neuronal ensembles in that synchrony. So when we talk about event-related synchronization, we're talking about, you know, enhanced alpha usually, and event-related desynchronization, we're talking about less alpha in relationship to that event. Okay. So there are a couple kinds of event-related synchronization that you can see with alpha. that is primary and that which is secondary. So here's the kind that follows event-related desynchronization. So this is alpha power time course from a few seconds before a button press to a few seconds after over the left central region during voluntary movements with the right and the left thumb. So this is the right thumb and it's over the left region. So right before and during the time of the movement, there is a decrease in alpha. That cortex has become active. And then following is this compensatory synchronization, or you know, a post-desynchronization synchronization. Okay. Oh, excuse me, that's the right thumb and that's the left thumb. The right thumb over the left region and the left central region. So we're looking here, and that's the right thumb. I would have expected more desynchronization there. But there's clearly a much more synchronization in that one than the other one. But you see it in both cases. That is one thing you'll see. There, we'll talk about something called lateralized readiness potential later, that even when people are making a lateralized response, you'll see changes in both primary motor cortices that are similar up to a point, and then at a choice, they diverge. So I wouldn't worry about the laterality in this picture quite as much right now, but you can see alpha blocking prior to the response, and then alpha synchronization following.
Can I just go back to the synchronization?
Yeah.
I guess I have a hard time with this because I think I always thought of it as desynchronization, but it's really like smaller groups that are going.
Right.
I
so.
Think
right. So to have slower and higher amplitude activity, you have to have larger neuronal pools of neuronal ensembles simultaneously active. Right. So we can think of that as synchronization. And desynchronization is they're functioning more independently. They're desynchronized from each other. But they're still synchronous. There has to be some synchronicity. The brain's not firing randomly.
Okay.
We can also see primary event-related synchronization in regions of the brain that are not going to be involved in a task. So here we have reading. They have to do some reading right here. And we see event-related desynchronization, alpha blocking, in the occipital region since they're going to be looking at visual input, and event-related synchronization in a lead that's over the primary motor cortex. And they're kind of simultaneous with each other, so primary synchronization. And then conversely, when they make a voluntary movement, we see that there's the alpha blocking, the desynchronization here over the primary motor cortex, and we see a synchronization over the visual cortex. So there's some specificity. The region of the brain that is necessary for the task shows alpha blocking. Other regions show alpha enhancement. And you can see it here as well. There's primary event-related desynchronization followed by some event-related synchronization here. You can see the alpha in the raw record. So there's alpha going on and there's blocking here just prior to making the movement. And at the time of the movement, there's synchronization here in the parietal and occipital leads, which wouldn't be necessary for making the movement. Okay. I'm going to leave you with a vexing thought, though. One that you can think of, what's the sound of one hand clapping until we get together next time. So if alpha desynchronizes, then what would synchronize? It implies that, okay, alpha's blocked. Something else must take over. There must be some higher frequency activity. So this was a study done by